Welcome, everybody, to the Committee on Labor, Workplace, and Regulated Industries. We're going to get started, so if you could quiet down for a little bit now and pay attention to the proceedings as the author comes up to the desk. First of all, we're going to move the minutes. Representative Sawick moves approval of minutes for March 13, 2013. Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Representative Nelson, welcome to the committee this morning. And would you like to move your bill?
I'll move House File 950 to pass and be referred to, where's it got to go? GovOps.
Representative Nelson moves that House File 950 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
I hear that chair's real tough.
And you have a an amendment to put the bill in the form you would like. Is that the
Mr. Chair, I have the DE4 amendment, and basically what that does is puts it in there, and it also puts the language from House File 844 into this to match up what they did in the Senate. They put these bills together.
Representative Nelson moves the DE4 amendment. Discussion. Representative.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, for people so that they know what the DE4 is, as Representative Nelson has suggested, it puts it in the form of the Senate. If you could just explain what the DE4 does and why it's being amended on here.
I can do that.
Representative Nelson.
The DE4 amendment. Both of these bills, House File 950 and House File 844. Are two different groups of people, but what it basically does is give them the right to organize and try and form a union, and so that the basic concept is the same, and that's why they merged them together in the Senate. And one is a group of family child care providers, the other group is of personal care attendants, I think is the common term that people understand, that give individual health care assistance and homes, and there are two different groups of people, and that just the basic concept of the two of them trying to give them the rights to be able to form and try and form a union is what this is about, and both of them are involved, so it did make some sense of what the Senate did, although I don't always agree with the Senate. They have crazy ways of doing things, but to try and make it easier when it comes to the final product, have the two match up together makes it easier for everybody.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nelson. Just another question. This is going to government operations after this. Can you give us a bill path on where this is going to go now that the two if in fact the two do get merged together by the committee action this morning?
Representative Nelson, do you have a sense of the path?
I believe it may have to go to Mahoney's committee, which is a finance committee from government operations, but I believe that's where it goes. I'm looking, and Mr. Kwapik is giving me a funny. I'm not sure what I haven't been told what the path after that is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My assumption would be that it may also find its way into some health and human service related committees as well.
It came, Mr. Chair, and Representative
Nelson
O'Driscoll, the 950 did come from health and human service, so that part was already there. Or no, excuse me, not 950, 844 was already in Health and Human Services.
Very good. And Representative Odrispo?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't see that because it's not a part of the DE amendment. It does say that the 950 did start in childhood and is now here for our consideration today, but I wasn't sure of the path of what the amended bill would be. So thank you for helping to clarify that.
Thank you, Representative
Odrispo. Mr. Chair, just for clarity, the 844, House File 844, started in Health and Human Services policy, went to civil law to deal with some of the data privacy issues, and now it's come here for the labor issues.
Very good. Any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor of adopting the DE4 amendment indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. We have the bill before us in a form that you like. Members, just kind of lay of the land here. What we're going to do is Representative Nelson is going to present this bill, explain what it is. We're going to move on to the testifiers. We're going to go 20 minutes, roughly, for each side to explain their pro or con perspective. So as you have your group of whoever is going to testify, plan on a group total of 20 minutes, and we're going to try to hold to that. So let's do that. Then we're going to move on to the amendments after that. I know there's several amendments that will be offered, and then we'll move on to further discussion after that point. So with that, let's start off with Mr. Side, if you'd have a seat at the chair, and identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, keeping in mind that we have other testifiers, and we have about 20 minutes for the pros.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Elliot Side. I am the executive director of AFSCME Council 5. Mr. Chairman and members, this legislation matters to AFSCME and all working families. It's about the human right to choose whether or not to have a union and a voice on the job. This is the same way that teachers, nurses, and social workers have organized across Minnesota for decades. Child care providers and home care workers deserve nothing less. Child care providers are uniting to advocate for quality care that parents can afford. We share common interests with the legislature. First, all of us want to give working parents peace of mind that the kids are that their kids are healthy, learning, and safe in the care of a well-trained provider. Secondly, we want to prepare kids for success in school and in life. And thirdly, we want to improve quality and affordability for all families. And finally, we should all want to stabilize the profession and reduce turnover by giving providers a stronger voice in decisions that affect their work. 16 states, Mr. Chairman and members, recognize the right of child care providers to bargain collectively with the state. There is nothing stopping Minnesota. Union providers have helped other states improve training, provide more consistent care with less turnover, increase quality and affordability for families, and ensure on-time payments for providers. Collective bargaining is a partnership. It's a partnership that will help the state maximize its investment in helping working parents to access quality child care. With your support, home-based providers can help the children in their care be ready for kindergarten and success in life. Child care providers deserve respect for doing one of the toughest and most important jobs imaginable, helping to raise our children, our most important resource. Today you will hear testimony from several members of Child Care Providers Together. They are professionals who are experienced, smart, dedicated, and loving. They want a union and a voice in their conditions and regulations and being able to help children in a better way. Mr. Chairman and members, I thank you for the opportunity to testify and look forward to answering any questions or assisting the committee in any other way possible.
Thank you, Side, for your testimony. And next up we have Lynn Barton from Douglas County Family Child Care Provider. And next up we have Carla Skopansky. If you want to wait over here and be ready to go, that would be great. And Lynn, if you'd identify yourself for the record, please, and go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Lynn Barton. Good morning, Mr.
Morning.
Chair, members of the committee. I've been a licensed family child care provider for the last 14 years and provided care in both Pope and Douglas County. It's critical work that child care providers do every day to care for the most vulnerable, the young children in our communities. I believe there's no job in the world more important than ours, caring for our future and helping parents create the strong foundation for children to live successful lives. I love the children in my care like my own, and I want what's best for them and me. I'm a successful business owner, and I want to be part of a child care union. I run my own business. Unionizing doesn't change that. I'll still negotiate my own price, my own hours, and my own terms with individual parents. This legislation gives child care providers the right to choose whether or not to join a union. We're smart. Let us make the choice. As a child care provider, I'm so proud of what I do. I prepare children for school, but this work involves much more than just learning the ABCs. I provide proper nutrition and opportunities to develop large and small motor skills indoors and outdoors. A home family child care provider provides opportunities for children to establish valuable social-emotional skills, essential to both working and playing with other children in order to develop a social skill set necessary for success in kindergarten and in life. I engage all the children with structured conversation and written literature so as to assist age-appropriate development and language acquisition at an earlier age. I'm always trying to make my program better, and the union helps me with that. Our union allows me to learn from other providers statewide and to further my professional development together with my peers. Half of Minnesota's children are not prepared for school. They're living in poverty with poor nutrition. If you want to solve these problems, you need to work with us. We are the experts who do the work. We fill the little tummies with healthy food. We prepare kids for school and success in life. Let's work together to make sure kids can eat and learn in the homes of well-trained child care providers. Our union is about dignity and respect as professionals. Our child care union represents the culture, diversity, and concerns of child care providers across our state, not just the metro area or one region of greater Minnesota. Our union gives us a strong, unified voice to someday achieve much more than we ever could do alone. Our child care union provides us with the opportunity to increase the quality of care by supporting them with affordable and accessible training. Our union is an opportunity to negotiate those decisions made by the state and our counties that directly impact our business, and to ensure that these decisions are negotiated with proper consideration of the realities of providing home family child care. Our union creates an opportunity to discuss affordable benefits, which are necessary to attract and retain top providers in our profession. In essence, our union helps lift some of the pressures off of running my business so I can focus on the most important part, the kids. Child care providers are uniting to provide quality care that parents can afford. Please support the Child Care Collective Bargaining Act to ensure that this happens. Kids benefit, families benefit, child care providers benefit, businesses benefit, Minnesota benefits.
Thank you, Ms. Barton, for your testimony. Ms. Kopinski, would you come up, identify yourself for the record? And after Ms. Kopinski, it looks like we have Ms. Aristi. Go ahead, identify yourself for the record. And begin,
good morning,
please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carla Skopinski, and I'm a licensed daycare provider in Benton County. I've been a provider for 14-plus years, and prior to opening my daycare, I worked in the school-age Kid Stop programs and preschool programs. I have a BS degree from the St. Cloud State University in criminal justice with an emphasis in traffic safety and other kinds of safety. I have been in several professions in my lifetime, all of which I chose in order to better serve the community. These were not easy decisions to make when moving from occupation to occupation, but as I did, I felt a feeling of accomplishment each brought me closer to making differences in people's lives. This final move was by far the most rewarding because I find myself influencing the decisions and growth process of our young children. I see there are many facets in this occupation where we are the only ones that advocate for them. This is not an easy job, and with the continual changes in the rules and regulations, I sometimes lose myself in what this job actually is. Caring for children has always been on the forefront from the time my children enter my daycare at 6:15 in the morning until they leave at 5:30 at night. In this time period, it is my goal to fill them with as much knowledge as possible. I'm running curriculum so as to educate them to be ready for kindergarten. Letters, numbers, shapes, colors, with an emphasis on holidays, seasons, proper hygiene and nutrition are just a few of the areas of concentration on any given day. Education is very important to the provider, and making the milestones is detrimental to this profession for each of my children in my care. We work in our homes. We are often isolated from peers that do the same work. We are affected by county inspectors, state regulators, and elected politicians. We need a seat at the table so we have a say about the rules, policies, and rates that affect our care we provide. We need a unified voice to have a direct impact in raising the standards and quality of our profession. Like all businesses, we need rules, regulations, and enforcement that is consistent. The health of our economy depends in part on working families having high quality, affordable, and dependable child care. So parents can work with peace of mind knowing their kids are healthy, learning, and safe. Please let us make the choice by supporting the Child Care Collective Bargaining Act.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Kopinski. And next up is Ms. Aristi. I'm pronouncing that correctly. If you'd have a seat at the table, identify yourself for the record, please, and go ahead with your testimony. On deck is Ms. Henry. Is Ms. Henry here? Have a stand over there, please. Go ahead.
Hello and good morning. My name is Doreen Aristi, and I have traveled here from New York. And I have traveled here because I want to support my fellow child care providers in Minnesota that also offer quality child care services. I've been caring for children in my home for over 20 years. And caring and teaching children in a home-based daycare is so much more than just babysitting. This business is very unique. It cannot be compared to any other business. Many times this business is not looked at with respect and recognition that providers truly deserve. I am here to tell you that our union works and how organizing has helped raise the standards of child care across New York State. I understand the impact of quality child care programs on children's development, families, and our community as a whole. Through our union, I am a trained trainer, and I travel across the state to teach other providers curriculum, nutrition, safety, business, and other important topics to providers. I understand that as citizens of the United States in a democratic society, we have rights, we have responsibilities, and we have choices. However, here in Minnesota, child care providers aren't even offered the right to make the choice. New York providers have had a contract with the state since 2009. We have been able to achieve many things through collective bargaining. A Bill of Rights, 17 guiding principles so providers are treated with respect and dignity. Representation on all state committees that affect our profession. A professional development fund to increase our skills with a guaranteed state funding allocation. A $500 per provider grant program. A dispute resolution procedure to settle issues over payments or issues with inspectors. An online system to process payments much more quickly. Through collective bargaining, we have more affordable access to health, liability, and homeowners insurance.
And then just another minute or so, Mr. Rusty.
Our major achievement is that our union contract commits our state to maintaining the reimbursement rate at the 75th percentile of the local market to ensure affordable child care for parents, which makes it easier for the financial stability. Providers can reinvest in our business with the financial stability given. Allowing child care providers the choice to form a union with collective bargaining will support the three R's: rights, recognition, and respect for the importance of the job we do. Collective bargaining will allow providers to have the choice of having a voice with a quality child care program in Minnesota, and allowing providers to organize will help to elevate the status of a profession as early child care educators. Children cared for by quality providers who is a union member are given the opportunity to learn and grow in a quality program. This in turn will have a positive impact on our future. Children who are taught by quality early childhood educators are more likely to become successful, contributing individuals to society. Allowing providers to collectively bargain will support providers' rights, recognition, and respect. Thank you for your time.
Very good. Thank you very much. And Representative O'Driscoll has a question for you. We're going to hold most of our questions till after testifying is done, but if you have something very specific and timely, as apparently Representative O'Driscoll does, let's go with it. Representative O'Driscoll?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the slight deviation from the plan today, but since Ms. Arsti is from New York, and I recognize all of the other organizations that are on our list here today and some of the small business owners from Minnesota who are going to testify, I'm just wondering if she could explain to us what Voice and CC is, since that's not something that I'm familiar with. I'm going to assume that the other members of the committee don't know what that organization or entity is and does as well.
How do you pronounce your name again?
Arsti.
Ms. Arsti, to Representative O'Driscoll's question, please.
Voice is a local union for independent child care providers. So it's not an association, but however, we do work with associations. Voice itself is Voice of Independent Early Child Care Educators, which is the name of our local union.
Further, Representative?
Yeah, and then the second part, and I'm assuming I'm saying that right, CC, because it's C.
C-S-E-A.
So I'm assuming it's C and C. CC?
Actually, it's the Civil Service Employees Association, which is, we umbrellaed under that labor union. This is new. It was uncharted areas for daycare providers to have a labor union. So CSEA was the local labor union that helped us organize and form.
Very good.
Yeah, just one final question.
Sorry,
do you have the opportunity to go across the country to with this organization to be at events like today to share your message and ideas?
Yes, sir.
Ms. Henry,
thank you.
Thank you. Very good. Thank you, Ms. Henry. If you want to step up to the or have a seat at the desk there and identify yourself.
And Mr.
For the
Chair,
record,
welcome. Some of us have trouble hearing her voice. I'm sure Representative Kahn would be able to understand every word she says.
And next, after Mr. Henry, is there Mark Kerwin here? If you are, please step up to the side over there. Go ahead, identify yourself, please. And
hello, Chair members. My name is Darlene. I'm 23 years old, and I'm from Rosemount. About 2 years ago, my mother had a series of three small strokes, which turned our lives upside down. Everything had changed. She now needed to be driven to her doctor appointments. She needed reminders to take pills, keep appointments, where to go in the grocery store, and to eat. She needed help preparing meals so she could save her energy for other important tasks. During this time of need, before I became her PCA, I missed half of my work days each week to care for my mother and was almost fired for being so unreliable. My mother chose me to be her PCA because she knew me. I had been with her during every hospital stay, and there were many. I could have easily chosen to stay with my better paying jobs, but how can you look at your parent, let alone anyone, and tell them no? So here I am now, with three jobs, working countless hours a week, with low wages and no benefits to show for it. I'm working so much because I dream of owning my own house someday, a dream that seems unrealistic with my situation as it stands. When I became my mother's PCA, I discovered there was absolutely no real training to prepare me for such a job. I had no CPR training, which I needed desperately after already having to call the ambulance for my mother multiple times in the past. I realized the pay was terrible for a career that I considered long-term and difficult. It took me a while before I realized all these issues, especially because I thought I was alone, but I'm not. There are many other home care workers who are struggling as I am to get by and save for the future. Right now, as it stands, I have no voice, no say in what happens in my career. I don't even have the right to choose to form a union, which is what I've realized the best solution we have. Why? Because I've realized the best people to represent myself and my fellow home care workers is myself and my fellow home care workers. This union I dream of wouldn't be made up of strangers who just want to take our money and steal our voice. It would be made up of the people who I've been working hard with for the past year, who I trust, who will give us a voice and help get us respect. We would have made sure that 20% cut for home care workers who worked for someone in their family would have never happened. Our union would help make families transition better during such a difficult time by providing specific training so that they would feel more prepared and not put any of their clients' life at risk. I'm still thrown back by the fact that in this amazing country, we have so many rights. Yet for home care workers, we still aren't allowed the right to choose to form a union. So I'm here today to plead with you today on my behalf and others' behalf for the others in the same position to give us the right to choose. Forming a union gives me hope that mine and my mother's future, as well as everyone else's, could only get better.
Thank you, Ms. Henry, for your testimony. Mr. Kerwin, if you want to step up and identify yourself for the record and begin with your testimony. And last on the pros, we have Dr. Howes. If you'd prepare yourself to go ahead, identify yourself for the record and begin.
Hi, thanks. My name is Mark Kerwin. I live in Northeast Minneapolis, and I'm a home care worker for my wife, Chrissy, through the Consumer Directed Community Supports Program. We've been married 21 years. We have two sons, 15 and 12. My wife, Chrissy, was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis when she was 18. And long story short, we've faced many challenges keeping our family together from both a financial and a medical perspective. Before I was getting paid, when Chrissy had to stop working in 1998 and I had to start providing her care, I was not getting paid. And we weren't making ends meet, and we it was looking like we were going to need to move Chrissy to a care facility because we couldn't pay the bills, and that changed when we got on the CDCS program and I was able to start getting paid. In 2007, Chrissy was hospitalized with a serious infection and ended up having to go to a care facility, and she was 40 years old at the and it was very sad to experience that, and she made it clear that she did not want to stay in the facility and wanted to go home, and we found out that she was eligible for a CAC waiver that would give her more funding to enable us to set up a system where she could go home. Now we have 52 hours a week of registered nursing, and I'm paid for 40 hours a week, and that was a huge relief for us, obviously, and Chrissy's been able to live now at home for about the last 6 years. CDCS has worked well for my family, allowing us to stay together, and that's why I feel an obligation to try to protect it and to improve it for others who face similar challenges as I have. CDCS has made it possible for us to remain living together at home, and so I'd like to protect it so that it works well for everyone, the people receiving the care, the workers providing the care, and taxpayers who benefit when expensive hospital visits are prevented and people stay in their own homes and out of costly health care facilities. People who do home care often do not expect to be in this situation. The need arises and they choose to set aside their jobs, pursuits of education, and career goals to take care of loved ones because there is no one else willing or able to do the job. We do not abandon our loved ones at the first opportunity that comes along to make more money. Many of us, including myself, have taken a cut in pay to work in this position. We often have years of experience that enables us to provide excellent care, and we are providing a valuable service and should be compensated fairly and given the resources we need to continue to do this job.
Mr. Curran, right here, kind of wind it up. We want to make sure Dr. Howes get a chance to.
Okay. We deserve to be able to have an organized voice, and I think we've seen the results of our inability to organize and speak as a group. There's been no increase in our budget for over 3 years, I believe. My current wage is less than it was 3 years ago. By forming a union, we can work to make sure that workers have the training they need and are compensated fairly to continue to do the job. As a home care worker, I don't like to be told that I don't have the right to form a union. Our funding could be cut or eliminated, and we would all be on our own trying to restore funding to keep our jobs. Having a unified voice would put us in a stronger position to negotiate larger budgets, and that would make it possible for workers to get the occasional modest raise, which would not cut into the hours of service the consumer would get. By uniting, we could work to improve access to health care coverage for those who need it, and help for those who need more training. It could help people who are having a hard time keeping good workers because of low wages. If we were able to form a union, that would not prevent healthcare consumers like my wife from being able to set up their own care plans. She will continue to control her budgets and make choices to best meet her needs. Being part of a union will make sure that our voices are heard and our concerns are taken seriously. It will help us continue to do the things that are working well and make improvements when necessary, and that's beneficial to everyone. Thanks.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Curran. Dr. Howes, if you want to have a seat at the table. The next group can prepare themselves. Vicki Schaffner, if you're around, be ready to go. Welcome, and again, identify yourself for the record, and you have about 3 or 4 minutes to share with us what you have.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Candace Howes. I'm a labor economist, professor, and chair of the economics department at Connecticut College. I hold a PhD in economics from the University of California, Berkeley, and I have done extensive research funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation on home care workers in California, which is part of the reason that I'm here today. I'm here to argue that collective bargaining for PCAs is very important, and I want to tell you why that's the case. The home care industry is the fastest growing industry in the United States, and it's the fastest growing industry in Minnesota as well. And that means that Minnesota is going to need many, many more home care workers in the next 10 years. In fact, projected expectations for growth in the home care workforce is about 47,000 over the next 10 years. PCAs, at least one in eight of every new job that's going to be created in Minnesota over the next 10 years is going to be a PCA or home health aide job. PCAs and home health aides will not be just a big share of the new jobs, but they're also a huge proportion of the jobs at the low end of the wage distribution. Perhaps as many as half of all new low-wage jobs in Minnesota will be, which are typically done by women, will be in these two occupations. That means to a very large extent that the home health and home care industry will set the standards for jobs at the low end of the wage distribution for women. Giving collective bargaining rights to these groups is the most effective way of increasing wages and benefits. Why is that? Many of these jobs, especially PCA and home care worker jobs, fall outside the normal institutional and legal framework within which jobs are usually regulated and worker protections are enforced. The jobs are not performed in normal workplaces, but rather in people's homes, where it is extremely difficult to design and enforce labor standards. It is virtually impossible for workers to congregate, share information, articulate concerns. Under consumer-directed programs, even when the state is paying the wages, the consumer acts as the employer for the purposes of hiring and firing and training. In the case of the consumer-directed community supports program in Minnesota, for example, the consumers can actually pay some workers a wage that is below the minimum wage. It is extremely important for Minnesota to establish the conditions for improving the quality of these jobs and improving care in this industry. Better jobs, it's been shown, much research has shown that better jobs, better quality jobs reduce the rate of turnover in the industry, which is one of the main factors which affects the quality of care. So let's look at California as an example of how effective collective bargaining can be. This is where I have done most of my research. California's Medicaid home care program is the largest publicly funded consumer-directed PCA service in the world. Nearly 80% of California's Medicaid-funded long-term care population is getting home care rather than institutional care. That's 450,000 consumers being cared for by about 400,000 home care providers, many of whom are covered by collective bargaining agreements. This is an extremely cost-effective way to provide long-term care. One of the reasons that Minnesota should expect to see a growing demand for home care service is because of this cost-effectiveness. Both Minnesota and California provide long-term care to about the same proportion of the population, but the per capita cost to taxpayers for the long-term care of the elderly and physically disabled is about 50% higher in Minnesota than it is in California. And that's because in Minnesota, only about 58% of the recipients are receiving home care.
And Dr. Howes, we've got about a minute left to kind of summarize your major points.
One of the questions I often encounter, the turnover rate in Minnesota is about 50%, which is about the turnover rate for the average turnover rate for the entire population of home care workers in the United States. However, and the reason that the turnover rate is so high is because I think it's well known here, the wages are quite low for home care workers in this in Minnesota relative to other low-wage workers. But if we look at California, you find in California where wages are above the mean for nationwide and where a very large proportion of the workers are actually covered by collective bargaining agreements, we find the following outcomes, the following results of being covered by these collective bargaining agreements. First, the average wage for PCAs is higher than the national median, and in those counties in California where there has been collective bargaining for some time, wages are almost 20% higher. California home care workers are less likely to be receiving public assistance compared to PCAs nationwide, whereas Minnesota home care workers are receiving a high percentage, about 30% of them are receiving public assistance. There are 50%, California home care workers are 50% more likely to have employer-based health insurance than PCAs nationwide. And I think most importantly, the turnover rate in California is half the national average and half the turnover rate of Minnesota PCAs. So I think that the evidence from California, where you have this considerable extensive collective bargaining, shows that the importance of both workforce councils and collective bargaining. The fact that they increase the likelihood that PCAs will get the basic labor protections to which they are entitled. Collective bargaining has been shown to raise household incomes and significantly reduce workers' dependence on public programs. Better jobs have stabilized the workforce, reducing turnover so that the consumers can get better quality care for providers who can afford to stay in the job.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony, Dr. House.
You're welcome.
Let's move on to the other side. Is Vicki Schaffner here? If not, Becky Swanson?
I'm here.
Oh, welcome.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record and begin with your testimony. And the same on the con side. We're going to try to keep it at 20 minutes, hours. We went over a little bit, and we'll provide you the same opportunity. But go ahead and identify yourself for the record, and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm actually Katie Chase. Vicki Schaffner scheduled me to speak, so apparently there was just a slight mix-up there.
Okay.
I'm the executive director of Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association. We oppose sections in House File 950 specific to family child care, but we will support the outcome of a full licensed provider vote. Bill language excludes half of the providers from voting, many of whom are willing and registered to accept families receiving CCAP assistance. A fair election would allow all licensed child care providers to vote. With the exception of the Child Care Assistance Program, in the meet and negotiate section, the issues listed are only for licensed child care providers. Licensed providers and unlicensed providers do not have the same state regulations. In Michigan and Illinois, the number of unlicensed providers eligible to vote was 3 to 5 times higher than the licensed providers. If every licensed provider voted no, the unlicensed vote could still have determined unionization for licensed providers. Allowing unlicensed providers to vote for an organization that will affect regulations for licensed providers is not equitable. When, on the issue of exclusive representation, providers should have the right to join any organization representing them, and that organization should have a seat at the table for negotiating issues impacting licensed providers. Furthermore, a union is not solely qualified to determine quality standards for children and professional development needs of providers. Organizations that have years of experience in these areas need to maintain the right to be at that table. Child care licensors are unionized by AFSCME. How can a union represent both sides of the arbitration table? The certification process language negates a secret ballot election if the union is able to collect enough cards. Some of the cards were obtained 7 years ago. Some of the providers who signed cards in the past are no longer providing care. MLFCCA has maintained a written record submitted to Governor Dayton of numerous provider complaints about the card collecting campaign and deceptive practices used to gain a signature, including gaining access to the home by saying they are a food program monitor for MLFCCA or Child Care Choices. Posted on our website and in a handout provided to you are the results of a survey with a 20% return rate, showing that over 86% of Minnesota's licensed providers do not want a union. Over 37% said they would stop serving families on CCAP if there was a union, and over 55% said they would raise their rates. A secret ballot election of all licensed child care providers would give every provider the opportunity to vote. While the union states that membership in the union is voluntary, if there is a family child care providers union, representation would not be voluntary. For this reason, all licensed providers should have the opportunity to vote. MLFCCA will support the outcome of a true majority vote. It is imperative that licensed providers are heard on this issue. Holding committee meetings in the evening is also necessary so that people can be here. Thank you so much for your time. I'll take questions if you have any.
Very briefly, Mr. Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and very briefly to the testifier, and I apologize if I missed it, but you said that you were opposed to certain sections in the bill, and I'm just wondering if you could specify which sections they are.
We're opposed to all sections. Katie Chase.
Go ahead.
Representative Chair, we are opposed to all sections that have anything to do with family child care, so we do oppose this bill.
Thank you.
Very good. Becky Swanson, if you'd please step up to the table, and I think next on the list is Julie Seidel. You'd be ready to go.
How are you this morning?
I'm good, thank you.
Welcome.
Met a few times.
And if you'd identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Becky Swanson. I've been a licensed child care provider for the last 26 years. I am opposed to this bill for the simple reason is this bill would not give me an opportunity to vote. I live in an area that does not service many CCAP children. I have had a few CCAP in the past, but presently do not. And because I have not had a child in my care in the last 12 months, it would not allow me to vote. One of the things I'd like to talk about to you today is we're oftentimes now being referred to as a worker. We're not workers, we are business owners. And that's a big distinction that we need to recognize. I look at the unlicensed child care providers more as what you would consider the workers. They are the babysitters. They don't have to abide by the rules and regulations in which we have to, but that are placed by you, the state of Minnesota. So I have to follow all the rules and regulations that are set by the state. They're implemented by my licensor, and I have to follow those rules. If I don't follow those rules, I risk losing my license, not being able to service child care in the state. On that note, I'd like to move into the business aspect of it. As a business person, I have to look at dollars and cents, profit and loss. If I am going to be, and my business is a service business of child care, if I am going to be in the union, I would have to pay my union dues, which was eloquently spoken by our friend from New York. She said dues in New York are a sliding fee, anywhere between $400 and $700 a year, depending on how many children you care for and the income you have. As a business person, I would have to decide whether or not I can afford that fee. Even if I choose not to join the union, I would still have to pay what is considered a fair share fee. So instead of looking at the families that I would be providing child care service at, I would now have to look at the CCAP families as, can I afford the additional fee that it's going to cost me to have them in my care? And I don't want to look at CCAP families that way. I want to continue servicing them as I have in the past without having to say, if I open my doors to a CCAP family, I also am opening my doors to either belonging to or not belonging to the union but paying a fair share fee. Do I and can I afford their fee? When it comes down to dollars and cents, can I afford an extra $400 to $700 to pay? And I'm only going by the rates that were given to us by New York, the lady from New York. So with that in consideration, you also, as our legislators, have the authority to set rules and regulations. You can change our CCAP reimbursement fees. We don't have to go through a third party. The union is a third party. They're basically negotiating the middle. I can go directly to you as a business owner and not pay the fees. I would hope you look at that as a business proposition and where we are at. Do we or do we not take CCAP children? Can we afford the extra cost? It would come from our businesses. And the other thing is please, we are not babysitters. We are private business owners. And you are lumping us together with unlicensed child care providers. And they do not have the rules and regulations that we have to follow.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. And Ms. Seidel, if you want to come down. Julie Seidel, if you're here, or Amanda Doerr. Next up after Amanda Doerr is Lisa Kampfer, if you'd be ready, Amanda. Or Ms. Doerr, if you want to identify yourself for the record and present your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Amanda Doerr, and I'm here representing AcroCare, which is a PCA choice provider and fiscal support entity for consumer-directed community support services, also known as CDCS. AcroCare opposes this legislation because it creates a great deal of uncertainty for care recipients, could force family members to join a union in order to receive a care entitlement, creates data privacy concerns for our providers, and results in more paperwork and costs for businesses like AcroCare. Further, unionization is not needed to advocate for a rate increase for direct care service providers. There's a misconception that this legislation would not apply to any care providers that work for an agency. That is not the case, as the PCA choice and CDCS providers working for AcroCare would be subject to the provisions of this bill. It all comes down to one word, control. The bill language reads, an individual provider does not mean an individual from an employee workforce assembled, directed, and controlled by a provider agency. The PCA choice and CDCS programs are deliberately designed to allow the individual recipient to choose, supervise, direct, and schedule their care provider in a manner that meets their personal care need. By design, it is the recipient that has the control, not AcroCare, so our workforce would be subject to this legislation. AcroCare helps recipients set up service with their caregivers. Through the PCA Choice Program, AcroCare performs the necessary background check and qualified professionals work with the recipient and the responsible party to develop a care plan. AcroCare submits all paperwork and billing to the states and provides the PCA's payroll. These PCAs are AcroCare employees. In the CDCS program, recipients can choose to carry the federal employee identification number and be the employee for their chosen caregiver, or else enter into a dual employer relationship with AcroCare. In either case, AcroCare administers payroll and expense processing. It's important to note that in many cases, the individual providers affected by this proposal are family members, parents caring for their disabled child, or adults caring for their aging parents. Does a son caring for his mother 10 hours a week need to pay union dues to do so? Will parents no longer be allowed to take an entitlement without joining a union? This bill also leaves much about its training requirements unknown. Who would pay for this training? How long would the training take? Would receiving this training result in delays in family member being able to provide care to their parent or child, thus taking away the patient's flexibility in choosing their caregiver? AcroCare also has concerns about the data privacy of our providers and recipients. Many times, the providers and recipients live under the same roof. So this list would, in effect, reveal who is receiving government funding. There are also providers who are 16 or 17 years old, so we have concerns about passing along the contact information for minors. All told, this list, compiled by DHS, would have about 31,000 provider names on it. If this bill passes, these 31,000 people will be considered state employees and their contact information could be passed along to a union. It's important to note that under the NLRA, any union could already approach AcroCare employees about representation. If 30% of our employees signed the cards, there'd be a union election. However, this bill sets up a separate process for direct care service providers. After 500 providers of the entire industry, not just our employees, express interest in organization, DHS would send a list of all providers to the union. Upon receipt of only 10% of the cards, there'd be a union election. Further, this bill does not include the PELRA requirement that a person work 14 hours or 35% of a traditional work week to be union eligible. All providers would be subject. AcroCare questions why a separate process for the direct service workforce is needed. Also, the union would negotiate with MMB, but the contract agreement would not be binding because it's ultimately the legislature that approves provider rates. The legislature currently has the power to increase provider rates, and that's something that these hardworking and dedicated employees deserve. Their work is not easy, and they should receive the best pay rate possible. This proposal will not result in improved care for program recipients or guarantee better wages for providers, but instead move Minnesota away from the self-directed services model that successfully meets recipients' lifestyle and personal care needs. We ask that you please consider the implications of this proposal and oppose this legislation.
Very good.
Thank you,
Ms. Dewar, for your testimony. Ms. Camper, want to come up and identify yourself for the record, please, and move ahead. And is Scott Price here? And be ready to go. Very good. Welcome.
Welcome.
Hi. Identify yourself and go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lisa Camper, and I am with Consumer Directions, a fiscal support entity certified by DHS to provide administrative and payroll support to families when they choose to employ their own workers. We serve approximately 650 individuals who are self-directing their services under CDCS, consumer-directed community supports. I have been an advocate of this model since it began in Minnesota in 1998. I am here to testify today because I oppose how this bill confuses the facts by grouping consumer-directed community supports with PCA Choice. These are separate programs and separate workforces. This bill takes away the core and fundamental principles of the CDCS participant being able to have the flexibility to set and determine their workers' wages. Here are the successes resulting from participant control over staff compensation and employment. The average wage for a CDCS worker is $13.26 per hour. This is actual data compiled by a collaboration of FSEs as of March 4, 2014. Additionally, we know that average length of tenure in CDCS is 34 months. 35% have worked 5 years or longer. 87.6% of this CDCS workforce is comprised of family and friends. These workers are predominantly doing this out of a labor of love, not in pursuit of a career in caregiving. This leads me to concerns. Will an older sister, a brother, a cousin, an aunt, an uncle, a grandparent, or a parent have to join a union to provide care to a loved one? CDCS is an evidence-based program that is working. These statistics do not support the need for a collective bargaining unit for the CDCS workers, as these statistics show that there is already a reliable, accessible, trained workforce of trusted caregivers with a low rate of staff turnover who are receiving better wages. Did you know that half of the people we serve under CDCS are set up as household domestic employers, and that they directly hire their employees under their own employer identification number? The IRS has recognized these employers as home health care service recipients. Under the definition in the National Labor Relations Act, any individual employed in the domestic service of any family or person in their home, or any individual employed by a parent or a spouse, is exempt. Please separate these workforces and consider amending this bill to exclude the participants who are household domestic employers. I would also like to address, so to speak, the elephant in the room, the unknown, the union dues. No one seems to know what this amount is going to be for these CDCS workers. But for simplicity, let's just say it's $10 a month, $120 a year. Doesn't sound like a very large number, but we estimate this to affect some 30,000 individuals. When I do that math, it's $3.6 million of state and federal Medicaid money being taken directly away from my clients and given to the union, SEIU, to help fix something that's not broken. Our clients are not okay with this, and you should not be okay with this. And I, as a taxpayer, am not okay with this. In closing, I would like to think we all have a shared value in supporting the philosophy of self-direction. And the resulting fiscal savings that consumer-directed community supports provides. And with that, we are committed and willing to work with the author so that we do not lose the viability of the self-directed models in Minnesota. Thank you.
And thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Price, if you want to come up and identify yourself and begin with your testimony. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott Price. I'm the parent of 6 adopted children. 4 have developmental disabilities. 2 are on the consumer-directed waivers. We have used consumer-directed waivers to enhance our children's lives in many ways over the last 12-plus years. One of the greatest benefits of having a consumer-directed waiver is having control over our staff. We have been able to keep our staff for an average of 3 to 5 years because of the competitive wages that we already pay. One of the concerns I have about allowing direct care workers to unionize along with other types of workers is the artificial setting of wages and benefits through a contract that has nothing to do with my family. Here's why I see unionization as a huge problem for consumer-directed recipients. If I must pay even $1 more per hour for 25 hours of staffing per week, given a static budget allocation, my budget shrinks by $1,500. Now we have fewer services for the same budget allocation. Even if I am not required to hire a union worker, I will be competing against the union wages when I look for staff. In essence, I will be forced to pay higher wages, which will shrink my budget as mentioned above. With a limited budget, an increase in the hourly rate means a decrease in the hours worked. So unionization just creates a new problem, namely shrinking budgets. And I am confident that the legislatures of the future are not going to be interested in hearing from me again when I come back to request an increased allocation to offset the contractually based wages and benefits that I would be forced to pay. In conclusion, let me give you the most dramatic example of where unionization combined with a limited budget is a failure. You're all familiar with this very important organization. It is the Postal Service. As a former 10-year employee, I can tell you that the day I quit, I saw that that organization was destined for the failure that it is today. Artificially set wages through demanding unions are a primary reason why the Postal Service is on the brink of extinction. Should you choose to allow unionization of workers who are employed by families through the consumer-directed waivers, I predict a similar collapse. The first to suffer will be the families, and ultimately the waiver and PCA programs will not be sustainable. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Price, for your testimony. Representative Nelson, you had a comment?
Mr. Chair and members, I think the Postal Service comment or analogy is kind of out of place, because if you look at any of the legislation or any of the stuff that's been coming out about the Postal Service, the reason the Postal Service is in trouble is because Congress forced them to pay for into the future for people who aren't even born yet and aren't even working for the Postal Service their full pension benefits going forward, and that's what the problem is. If they were able to, in a normal fashion, like every other company, pay for their pension benefits, they would have made a $4 billion profit, I think is the one number I saw. But anyway,
I think that's just an unfair analogy. Now we have some amendments, members, that I think it might be a good time to take up. And I know Representative Nelson, you have a technical amendment.
Just a couple of things, if I could, Mr. Chair. Just to draw members' attention, there were a number of written submissions, and as I've gone through those, I found many of the comments in there to be some similar to what we heard today, but others that are not. Many of them were in opposition to what's being advocated here. Secondly, Mr. Chair, if I could, there was a document that was passed around that I'm just not sure the source of this, and maybe you could help us find out who it was that provided this. It talks about the Minnesota Licensed Daycare Family Association, and I guess this is, I'd like them to talk about the methodology and how they came up with this information, because there's clearly some stark differences in here between a yes and a no on the questions that are here, and I think that it warrants a little bit of committee discussion other than a handout and just a line graph form with no explanation as to what the questions were and the methodology behind there, just on its face.
Right. first we'll take a look at the amendments, but if the person is here, is the person here who handed out the...
I am.
Okay, we'll get back to you then, oh. Ms. Chase. Let's start off with the...
Mr. Chair, the A34 amendment, I'd like to move that. That's a technical amendment.
Representative Nelson moves the A34 amendment, a technical amendment. Any discussion?
And what it does is it just basically it says the commissioner on that line is the Commissioner of Human Services.
Very good. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. We have that amendment adopted. We'll move to the A26 amendment. Who's offering that?
Mr. Chair, I will.
Representative Kiefer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
To your amendment, please.
Thank you. I guess the question would be, is there any potential that a PCA would, or maybe a child care provider, too, would be under the age of 18?
Representative Nelson?
Yes, it's possible, Mr. Okay. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kiefer?
Then I would like to move this amendment that would require... parental consent for anyone under 18 to join the union, and that's the A26 amendment if you want to see the exact language. Okay. And Mr. Chair, I'd ask for a roll call on this.
Roll call being requested. Representative Nelson, to the amendment, do you want to...
Mr. Chair, I oppose the amendment, number one. That's not the case in any other union vote. You got the... In the grocery stores, UFCW, if you're working for a grocery store that's covered by a union, if you're under 18, you're able to join the union. It's also going counter to the First Amendment of our U.S. Constitution.
Very good. Representative Hoppe?
Well, Mr. Chair, to that point, in Representative Nelson, my daughter's 15. Are you telling me that she might have to join a union if she's out babysitting and I don't get a say in that? Is that what I'm understanding you to say?
Representative Nelson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, that's not what I'm saying. If she's out babysitting and she's not part of a child care organization, no, that she wouldn't be forced to join a union.
So, Mr. Chair, just to clarify, so Representative Nelson, so if my daughter is out working and babysitting for family member or neighbors, friends, she is not going to be forced to join a union?
Representative Nelson?
Mr. Representative Sheldon and Representative Johnson and Representative Hoppe, I don't know. I guess I don't. The question is, I don't know because the particulars of what you're saying could be different. And I think there's some.
Mr. Chair, if that's the case, and we don't know, and my 15-year-old daughter can be unionized without my consent. I think we table this bill immediately, and I think everybody at this table should share that same concern. This is unconscionable if that's the case. Mr. Chair, I move that we table this bill.
Second.
Representative Hoppe moves to...
Mr. Chair, I'd like a roll call on that. This is unbelievable. If that's the case, I cannot believe we're even considering that.
That's...
We'll take the roll call on the motion to table.
Johnson.
No.
Benson.
Yes.
Fisher.
No.
Hoppe.
Yes.
Kiefer.
Yes.
Lane.
No.
Mason.
No.
Metza.
No.
Nelson.
No.
O'Driscoll.
Yes.
O'Neill. Savick.
No.
Simonson?
No.
Sundin?
No.
Uglem?
Yes.
5-9, motion does not prevail. Back to the amendment.
Mr. Chair, to that point, my son's 13. What if he babysits? Could he be forced to join a union? Where do we draw a line? Well, Mr. Side, if you're upset about this, why don't you come down here and try to defend it?
Mr. Side,
Representative Nelson,
Chair, Mr. Chair, if they're taking CCAP money, and that's where they is. If they're babysitting for a neighbor or a friend or a family member, they're not taking CCAP money. They would not be party to this.
Very good, Representative Fisher.
And this kind of goes to a little bit of some of this current discussion going on here. As I've read through here, I have not seen any documentation anywhere in here that spells out saying anyone has to belong to a union. I have not seen anything from
the first line all the way to the end saying somebody has to belong to a union. So number one, I just want to make sure that's cleared up. Number two, the other thing that I'd like to point out is that people having the option to join, I heard the reference to those that are under 18. My daughter works at a place that is unionized. She had the right to decide whether she wanted to belong to the union or not. I felt my daughter was old enough to make that decision on her own, and she made that decision on her own. I think when people are at the age of 16 and 17 who are very responsible, they have the right to be able to make those decisions themselves, and I should not be there telling them what they should or should not be doing.
Very good. Representative Metza?
I just want to point out that I don't think your comments were in order for this discussion, and I think it's getting a little off track with that.
So. Well, Mr. Chair, to that point, in Representative Metza, I asked the author a question about whether my daughter would have to join. He said, I don't know.
You didn't give a very specific
question. Representative Metza.
And I'll leave it at that. Thank
very
you.
Good. Well, Mr. Chair, I won't leave it there. Representative Metza, finish what you started. I asked a specific question. Would my daughter, who's 15, be forced to join a union? The author of the bill said, I don't know. How is that not on point to you, Representative Metza?
Where is she working? Who is she working for? Let's get specific with those kind of things before you start making allegations.
Okay, then you make those points.
Rest
and don't.
Hoppe, you want to go through the chair, please?
I'll let it rest, Mr. Chair.
To the 826 amendment roll call being requested.
Mr. Chair.
Mr.
I think there is other discussion to to this matter. Maybe
go ahead,
the author,
Representative Driscoll.
Maybe the author can help us to identify who then would be eligible on this, Representative Nelson.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, as I stated after and was given the information, people that take CCAP money would be the ones that would be part of that bargaining unit. And if they don't take CCAP money, if they're babysitting, then they would not be eligible. They would not be required to join any union.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, that's perhaps the side for the child care, but what about the PCA side of this? My understanding is that about 80% of the people that receive those services are from family members, and it may be that it's, to Representative Fisher's point, maybe not all people who are 16 and 17, the parents think that they're mature enough to be able to make those decisions. All we're asking for is that we maintain parental control here, that they have the opportunity to watch over their children and help them to make good decisions until the age of legal majority. I don't think that that's an unreasonable request.
Very good. Representative Kiefer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of follow-ups. I have the same concerns. With a PCA, oftentimes it's a child taking care of maybe a sibling or a parent that needs the help. I see real conflicts of interest here in this bill to unionize against your parents, and it's just unbelievably bad legislation. Rep. Fisher's point about a child joining a union, and they are considered child under the law till they're 18, but would she then be, if she chose not to join the union, she'd still have to pay her fair share, I'm sure. So this is not just a free, oh, this is a no-brainer. This is a huge piece of legislation that's mucking up a system that seems to work. 80% of the people in this don't want it. So I am going to ask for a vote on this simple amendment.
That's very cool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Roll call being requested on the 826 amendment. The clerk will take the roll.
Johnson.
No.
Benson.
Yes.
Fisher.
No.
Hoppe?
Yes.
Kiefer?
Yes.
Lane?
No.
Mason?
No.
Metza?
No.
Nelson?
No.
O'Driscoll?
Yes.
O'Neill?
Yes.
Savick?
No.
Simonson?
No.
Sundin?
No.
Uglem?
Yes.
Motion 6-9. The motion does not prevail. Who has the 827 amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I have it.
Representative Benson, to your amendment, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the author.
Would you like to move your amendment?
I would. The H950A27 amendment.
Representative Benson moves the A27 amendment. To your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author.
this amendment really is to provide some comfort for clarification. What I have some issue with is that it would seem that the bill doesn't allow for the potential for other associations once the union, if the union is formed, and then would preclude these associations or even individuals the opportunity to come before the legislature and testify like was done here today if they have issues concerning the conditions of work, wages, any number of things, the rules, the regulations, and so on. So really this is an addition to the bill so that it provides some comfort that these associations, some that already exist and others that may want to form in at a later date, would still have the ability to do that.
Representative Nelson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, there's nothing in this legislation that prohibits anyone from joining any other organization, and there's actually specific language in here to allow other organizations and groups and interested parties to be able to talk to the legislature, to lobby, to participate in meeting and conferring with the government on issues dealing with both the PCAs and the child care workers.
Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, can you point me to that specific language in the bill that allows for that?
And the DE form on page in lines 5.28, no provision or any agreement reached between the state or the exclusive individuals will interfere with the rights of participants or participants' representatives to select, hire, direct, or supervise or terminate employees. That's one section. And in line 4.8, the rights and obligations of any state agency to communicate or meet with any citizen, including other family child care providers, organizations concerning child care providers, legislation and regulations and on regulations and policies, we have specific language in there for that, and we've had specific language in there for that in the PCA bill.
Representative Benson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Representative, there would be absolutely nothing wrong with another association, even those that have spoke today, or an individual coming before either the agency or the legislature. So we have it clearly on the record to advocate for on behalf of individuals.
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, no. There's nothing in here. In fact, we've specifically put language in to make that clear.
Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I withdraw the amendment then.
The amendment's withdrawn. We'll move on to the 828th Amendment. Who's offering that?
Mr. Chair, I'm offering that.
Representative, are you going to... Would you like to move your amendment?
I'd like to move the 828 amendment.
Representative, you're going to move the 828 amendment to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, I think I have an amendment here that actually has a chance. Okay? This is an amendment that I think is a good common sense amendment, kind of in the interest of fair play and freedom of choice, if you will. It simply says that if the person joins a union, they do have an opportunity to rescind their membership in the union. I think that's something that this country's based on, the opportunity to say, okay, I have a choice. I have a choice. So I think it's logical. I think we all know how this committee is going to report this bill out and everything else. We'd like to make it as best we can. And this gives a number of child care providers a choice. That being said, I would ask for rules. That being said, I would ask for a roll call, however.
Roll call being requested. Representative Nelson to...
Mr. Chairman and Representative Uglum and members, this is current law. Current law in PELRA and National Labor Relations Act both allow any member who joins a union to rescind their membership and leave at any time. This is current law, and I believe it's unnecessary, so I will not support the amendment.
Very good. Any further discussion? Representative O'Driscoll.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, I appreciate your references to PELRA, because then I'm pretty sure you're going to support another amendment that we have, that because there's some exceptions to PELRA in here, and all we're trying to do is just show up and make sure that we don't have an attack on PELRA with this bill as relates to worker rights on this. So I think that the Uglem Amendment has a lot of merit, and all it does is provide some comfort language and reassures those who were here today testifying that they still have those rights. And I don't think that that's just an unreasonable request. And just a few minutes ago, you referenced the First Amendment. This is a First Amendment issue right here, so I'm sure you're going to support it with us.
Representative Uglem?
Mr. Chair, I guess it's really important that we do get this on the record, if it is part of PELRA and so on and so forth, but it sure can't hurt to put it on the record and vote for this amendment. Thank you.
Okay, further discussion, hearing none, roll call. That will be requested. Clerk will take the roll.
Johnson?
No.
Benson?
Yes.
Fisher?
No.
Hoppe?
Yes.
Kiefer?
Yes.
Lane?
No.
Mason?
No.
Metza?
No.
Nelson?
No.
O'Driscoll?
Yes.
O'Neill?
Yes.
Savick?
No.
Simonson?
No.
Sundin?
No.
Uglem?
Yes. 6-9.
Vote of 6-9. Motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. We have the 830 amendment before us. Who's offering that? 830 amendment? We'll go to the 832 amendment then. Who's offering the 832 amendment?
Well, Mr. Chair, I've got the 832 amendment, and I referenced that just before we had the conversation here just a few minutes ago. That
would you like to move that amendment?
Oh, absolutely. I move the amendment of the 832.
The 832 amendment. We have the amendment before us. To the amendment, Representative Driscoll.
Thank you. Real simple. It just reinforces and holds our requirements under PELRA that we have to have 30% or more calling for the vote on the unionization, where this drops it in the bill to below that threshold. And again, I know that PELRA is an important item to Representative Nelson and to others in the collective bargaining realm, and I just want to make sure that we're preserving that right for everyone and not just doing special carve-outs here for others. We're treating everybody the same under the law. So I would encourage everybody to vote for this, and I'm hoping that Representative Nelson would support PELRA on this one as well.
Representative Nelson to the amendment.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, with the purpose of the 30% or the 10% is to prevent frivolous elections. In the case here, the state of Minnesota, the employer, can waive that 30% right and go to a lower number, and it's been done in the past by the state of Minnesota, by other employers. The reason for the 10% on both of these goes back to the fact that these people are not in a standard workplace. If you're in the post office and everybody works in one place, or if you're in a factory and you all work in one place, it's easy to get and talk to these people all at one place, talk at lunch, share information back and forth, and so you can get to the 30%. Because these people are in all corners of the state of Minnesota, in individual homes and in individual places, getting the 10% is going to be a tough nut to crack to get to that, and get to a 30% would be even tougher nut to crack. But this is going to show interest, and it'd get it to the point where if they choose to form a union, they're going to be able to have the right to vote on it. And that's why I oppose the amendment and wish it to stay at 10%, because we can and done that in the past, and it's nothing that out of line.
Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, what I'm hearing is it's going to be hard to reach the rural providers. It'd be much easier to get 30% if this was more of a metro area. I know my district's like 20 square miles. It's pretty easy to cover. However, I have a real problem with that, because I think potentially the rural providers are the ones that are going to be at the most risk of unintended bad consequences of this legislation. So I think it's really important, especially to reach out across the state and make sure that we have a good voice. And we're not even asking for 50%, 30%. I think that's fair. I think everyone in this committee, I can't believe you wouldn't agree that that would be a fair amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good. Representative Benson, and back to you, Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know, to the representative, is it not the case that a daycare worker could already join the union if they so desired? Do you have an idea of how many people over the last few years have decided that they want to join the union?
Representative Nelson?
It's a rhetorical question, because I think I have the answer.
I have a rhetorical question. I know there have been some that have joined and have formed, but I don't know what the number is. Maybe somebody here can write me a note and and it's voluntary. But I don't know what the number is.
It's okay.
And it's to the point about the number of the election. It's not just a metro. If you heard the two people that came up here to testify for a union, we're both outstate members. They weren't from the metro area. So we're not, like I said, this is going to be just to get to an election. Once they get to the election, it's going to be a mail ballot to everybody in the state. So there will still be an election. It's not going to be just from the metro area, as was inferred here. It's going to be statewide.
Representative Driscoll?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Representative Benson.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, follow up, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the number, and I'm not 100% certain, is around 57. So what it smacks of is that we need to lower it to 10% so you have any kind of chance at all to find enough people to see if they want even the election. So I implore you, I mean, just out of a sense of fairness to the public, when this reaches the paper, and it's really going to hit the fan in the next couple of weeks, that it doesn't look like the legislature bent it down and made it a lot easier for this particular group to organize than any other group.
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, this is no different than other elections that have been held with the state and unions, and so that's why with the 10% is there.
Representative Benson.
Yeah, thank you. That's the second time I've heard that. Can you tell me which other unions were given that ability to do that?
Representative Nelson.
My two friends here can't phone a friends can't give me that information, but I've heard that previously. So I'll have to find that out.
Representative Driscoll.
Well, Mr. Chair, I didn't originally call for a roll call because I really believed that Representative Nelson would support Pelta and the 30%, so I'm going to ask for a roll call on this. And I tend to disagree that getting that 10% mark is going to be difficult. We've got the 7-county metro area where the majority of the population in the state of Minnesota is. The information on who the licensed daycare providers is already public information. You can go request that list. You can send out the ballot. I mean, the 30% is even a low mark on this. Dropping at 10% seems like it's a chip shot to the goalpost. I just think that 30% makes a lot of sense. Just keeping consistent, there was some logic and thought that went into the 30% number. Now we're dropping it because we've done it somewhere else, we think, but we can't confirm. I think it's easy to get a hold of these folks, particularly with the technology that we have these days.
Roll call being requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Johnson.
No.
Benson.
Yes.
Fisher.
No.
Hoppy.
Yes.
Kiefer?
Yes.
Lane?
No.
Mason?
No.
Metza?
No.
Nelson?
No.
O'Driscoll?
Yes.
O'Neill?
Yes.
Savick?
No.
Simonson?
No.
Sundin?
No.
Uglem?
Yes.
A vote of 6-9, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. We have no other amendments before us, I don't believe. So, Representative Nelson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And this would have been my opening statement, but we went right to the testimony to make it to move things along. But there's two things here. There's things that this bill does, and there's things that it doesn't do. What it does, it allows interested parties to join together to raise their collective voices, to raise the quality and standards of their chosen professions. And they can do this through discussions of best practices, they're working to raise the reimbursement rates from the states, and it allows those interested the ability to pursue the formation of a union. And that's why we're here. What it doesn't do, doesn't tell providers, doesn't tell PCA clients how to interact with their workers. Doesn't tell providers how to child care providers how to raise or care for kids, and it doesn't tell parents that. It doesn't guarantee that a union will be formed. I mean, that's why we're here in this committee today. It's about allowing these people the opportunity to go through the process to be able to try and form a union.
Representative Nelson, let me just interrupt you just for a second before you kind of give your closing comments, because I did promise Representative Driscoll the opportunity to address this handout.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was also wondering if we were going to have committee debate on the bill itself. We heard the testifiers. Yep. We had debate on the amendments, but we've not talked about the bill itself. And since it's been married together,
right,
two pretty controversial bills, they've been working through the legislature have been married together today, and this committee's not going to have the chance to debate.
And no, to your question, Representative Driscoll, once Representative Nelson presents his final summary, then we'll open up for further
Thank debate. You. I appreciate the support, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Anyway. And Representative Driscoll?
We had an individual who had passed this out, and if she could come to the testifying table and maybe just give us a little bit of background as to what they did, why they did it. I always just hate things that are dropped here that you just come from the sky and you just don't know the source, and I think that since there's some
Ma'am, if you pretty big evidence yourself here, for the record,
talk about where it came from.
And say a little bit about this handout that you gave, where it came from, that
Thank
sort of
you.
Thing, and Representative Driscoll might have a follow-up question.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Katie Chase, Executive Director of Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association. We're the affiliate to National Association for Family Child Care. Our infrastructure is, we have numerous county associations that are our members, as well as individual members, reaching about 5,000 providers in the state of Minnesota. We do represent all of the almost 11,000 providers. So we have a much larger membership right now than the union does. But we are, our mission is to uphold the highest standard of care for children in Minnesota's diverse licensed family child care homes. We do that through professional development, resources, recognition, and such. Our board of directors is actually representatives from all of the county associations. They are family child care providers themselves from rural Minnesota as well as the metro. And they got increasingly concerned as this bill moved very quickly that there was no organization and no legislative process in place to actually poll the people and find out what it is that our Minnesota providers want. So we quickly put together a Survey Monkey. We don't pretend to be any fancy dancy statisticians, but this is raw data from a Survey Monkey. And as you can see from the note on it, we took there again, there's about 11,000 licensed providers in Minnesota. Only 8,693 of those have posted emails as from the Department of Human Services list. We regularly email blast all of these people on various issues.
Well,
and this was the these were the results we got. The questions are listed at the top of each page. That's exactly actually.
Well, thank you for that information. I want to make sure, Representative Driscoll, if you have any further questions.
Well, I guess I do, Mr. Chair, because you know what's kind of interesting is if members have this, the item at the bottom, last sentence on the first page says, the 1,780 respondents in this survey represents 20% return rate. But we're worried about getting 10% response rate. And we just voted down an amendment to change PELRA for this particular thing. But 20% on a random survey, I just find it real interesting that we're, again, I'll use the analogy, putting a chip shot to the goalpost here.
Very good. Well, thank you for your testimony. I think that'll do for now. And Representative Nelson, again, to your bill. And then what we're going to do is, if you want to just kind of prevent your summary comments as you are continuing there, and then we're going to open it up to the...
Again, what it doesn't do, it doesn't guarantee that a union will be formed. I mean, that's there's been some talk about that. They're talking about a union, but this isn't going to give people the opportunity to work to try and form a union. And it's not going to be an easy task. And if this survey is accurate, it's not going to be a very easy task at all, and it probably will fail if their survey information is accurate. What this is about is letting child care providers and PCA providers to be able to vote. And all we've been heard a lot about choice and personal choice about whether they want to be in the union or not. This will give these two groups the ability to vote on that. It's about, again, it's about, with the child care piece of it, it's about preparing our kids for kindergarten and being ready to be succeed in school. And it's about people that need personal care attendance, the ability to be able to have a way to select them, and so that they're not having to go on Craigslist to hire people and having a list to select people from if they don't have family members to do that. And that's the gist of the bill.
Thank you, President Nelson. Representative O'Driscoll?
Mr. Chair, just procedurally, I know we were going to start a discussion in the committee, but I don't think we've had the opportunity for just public testimony. We had the prepared testimonies and the different interested groups, and I just want to make sure that if there's anybody here today from the general public that wanted to weigh in that didn't have a chance, that they'd also have that opportunity today.
Very good. Good reminder, Representative O'Driscoll. Is there anyone here who wished to testify, didn't have the opportunity, wants to give a brief comment? You're welcome to do so at this time. Seeing none, we're back to the members and comments to the bill. Representative Benson, I think you had a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can we also ask that some of the testifiers come up to answer questions?
Yes.
So I'd like to hear from Mr. Said, if I could, please.
Go ahead with your question as he's coming up, Mr. Said, if you'd have a seat at the bench, please.
Thank you. You in your statement, Mr. Said, you said that that unionizing the daycare PCA would improve care, lower costs. And you also stated that there was that it would rectify issues regarding getting payment on time. So I wondered if you could help us understand what how you could give us some qualitative, quantitative evidence to the fact that this indeed will improve the quality of daycare, PCAs lower their costs, if you will, and explain how you arrived at that we have a problem with payments.
Mr. Said.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, thank you for the question, sir. The one of the things that we would do is try to increase the child care subsidy. If a parent gets a larger child care subsidy, that makes it more affordable for the parent and also more affordable for the provider. So that would be one issue. Secondly, last session, the legislature was last session. The legislature cut the CCAP for licensed providers and for unlicensed providers by significant amounts. This would help the child care providers advocate for greater assistance for parents, which would also lower their costs and make it more affordable for the child care providers. Do we know that child care providers are paid less than the minimum wage throughout the state on average, and we have a public policy person here who can answer that question for you what it is. And what this would help do is make this the providers who take care of our most valuable resource, children, and I, by the way, had both my children with family child care providers. It allows them to have more opportunity for training, more opportunity for to help parents by advocating for the child care assistance program. And finally, there is a tremendous waiting list right now, over 6,000 folks waiting. The most affordable form of child care is family child care, and we have to make sure that that stays that way by increasing the child care subsidy and making it more affordable for the child care providers by increasing that subsidy. If we increase the subsidy, the parents have a less expensive proposition, and the providers have more affordability. And finally, let me just add that rules and regulations are dealt with differently in different parts of the state. They're applied differently. This would give the providers a voice on the application of rules, which are applied, rather arbitrarily in different places around the state.
Representative Benson, follow up.
Yes, please. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Said, and maybe the author, too. What I didn't hear is that it would lower cost. What I heard was that the folks who are getting the services through CCAP may pay less because the subsidy could go up. But in terms of lowering the cost to the state of Minnesota, the whole economy, I didn't hear anything that would lead me to believe that that's the case. And so we're looking to unionize to give better representation when, in fact, the author's party has control of both houses and the governorship. If we really wanted to worry about getting more money to the people that you believe that need more, they could just pass a simple funding bill that increases the amount of money these folks get, and it would be a whole lot less effort than going through the issues that's before us today in terms of unionization. So please help me understand. You didn't give me any evidence that we're going to lower costs. There's a certain segment of society, of course, that would benefit from it.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Said?
Mr. Chair, also Dr. Howes, who's from Connecticut, who spoke earlier, she can answer some of those questions if you'd like.
certainly looks like is there
we have a public
else?
Policy expert here on the child care.
Did you want to address the question Representative Benson posed? If you identify yourself before answering the question, please.
Chair Johnson, my name is Jennifer Munt. I'm the Public Policy Director for AFSCME Council 5. With respect to Representative Benson's question, our argument is that if parents want affordable child care, the best way to find that is at a home-based provider. And the paradox with child care is that parents can't pay more while providers can't earn less. Today, child care providers earn less than a minimum wage. According to DHS, on average, they earn $4.95 an hour in the metro area, $2.83 in Greater Minnesota. In order to make a living wage, they would have to raise the costs for parents. But parents who receive CCAP simply can't pay more. We believe that it's the state's responsibility to invest in the early education of our children. The majority of Minnesotans today believe that we need to raise the minimum wage. We believe that it's the state's responsibility to pay child care providers a living wage, and that way the parents can afford child care because nobody can pay more and nobody can work for less. We are not saying that this will save the state money. We are saying that this is an investment that we must make. As the Federal Reserve has said, every dollar invested in early care and education gives you a $16 return. That's an investment the state should make.
Representative Benson, you had a follow-up?
Oh, thank you. She made my point, and that, in fact, the cost is going to go up. Unionization and paying union dues is just going to add another layer of cost to an already taxed system. And simple economics. Eventually, the people who get paid this, paying the union dues, are going to have to get an increase also. So in as much as the folks that are getting the services may pay less, the people that have to provide the services are going to have to get paid more. Thank you.
All right, very good.
Dr. Howell would like to add.
All right, Dr. Howell is going to comment. Members, what we're going to do, just we got a little roadmap here. We're going to take a recess in just a matter of minutes and reconvene to the call of the chair.
So, as I understand...
And we're going to, and just let me finish what I have to say here. I'm going to reconvene 300 South at 3:30, just for your planning purposes, which is immediately following session, I believe. So go ahead,
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative, as I understand the question, it is how can collective bargaining and increased reimbursement rates possibly lower costs for the provision of long-term care, in particular home care or personal care assistance? There's a lot of hidden costs in low wages, and one of those hidden costs is the high rate of turnover. And there have been considerable number of studies done on the impact of reducing turnover on the actual cost of provision of the service. One of the first things is that if you reduce turnover, the number of people who end up in nursing homes or in urgent care or emergency rooms goes down. So the cost to the state for the provision of those kinds of emergency medical services goes down. Secondly, the providers of home care, many of them, the PCAs, many of them, about 30% of them in Minnesota right now are eligible for all sorts of assistive, all sorts of support services that if their wages went up, they would no longer be eligible for. So, for example, nationwide, 30%, and this is true in Minnesota as well, 30% of PCAs are actually eligible for publicly provided health care.
And Dr. Howell, that's sufficient for now. We're going to take a recess now to the call of the chair. Actually, we'll make it 3:30 and 300 South. 3:30 and 300 South, we'll be reconvening to
Mr. Chair, will testifiers be there so members can have a chance to ask
testifiers
some questions?
Testifiers are welcome to be there. Hopefully they can be. Meeting's in recess till 3:30, 300 South.
Welcome, everyone. This evening we're going to reconvene tonight's committee meeting. And I'm looking at, in terms of time frame here, having a vote by within at least 45 minutes. So make sure you get time for members to ask questions. We're at the question-asking phase, I believe, and if anyone else didn't testify they wanted to say something, they certainly have to be willing to do so. So Representative Nelson, I can't remember, did you give a summary? You want to say a few summary comments and then we can open up to questions again?
Well, basically what I said is what the bill does is it gives people who want the opportunity to organize and form a collective bargaining unit the ability to do that, but it does not guarantee that that's going to happen, and it doesn't require that anyone join the union. So that's the basic talking point, and that's the basic summation I'll give right now, and I'll stand for any questions. And
we're going to open it up for questions to members then. Representative Benson?
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess I'd like to get something on the record. We had testimony from a Doreen Aristi, who is from New York and part of the Voice CSCA, a New York family care provider, and a union member, union activist, was flown out here to give testimony. One of the things that I didn't hear, however, in her testimony today, and I don't see her, maybe plane back. She did mention the fact, I believe, that that providers pay a sliding scale between $400 and $700 per year. But I think the more important piece is I think that the union was formed, if I'm not mistaken, by the record 2009. And I think we need to have it said here because she did have to admit this in the Senate hearing, I believe. But since the union took over, that the provider rates are still exactly the same. They're at 75%. So it's for their $400 to $700 per year, they've provided absolutely no increase at all to the people that they represent. So I wanted to get that on record. And Mr. Chairman, I have several. I don't know. I don't want to hog all these. I know that we've got several that were prepared. But questions for the author. Just so that we know and we have it on record from your statements, what can the union provide that already wouldn't be accomplished by a trade or professional association of PCAs or child care providers? I mean, we already have a fairly substantial one for the licensed ones, but just so that we know from the author's perspective, what will the union do that they can't already do?
Representative Nelson?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Benson, the union will give these people the solidarity of a voice, and it's not a lot different than an association that you're talking about, other than that the association is more employers groups, but what happened with when you quoted the, and I asked about that, you quoted the wages that they, or the dues that they had out there. What she said in the Senate hearing also, I was told, is that they were helped to prevent a cut in those rates, where other states, including Minnesota, did have those cuts. So that's one thing that those union dues did accomplish, was help them to prevent further cuts in the reimbursement rates to child care workers.
Okay. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How about the PC? How about for the personal care attendants?
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair.
If you want to identify yourself for the record, please, and pull the mic over to you.
David Zaffron, Public Policy Specialist with SEIU Healthcare Minnesota.
So, Representative Benson's question.
Representative Benson, home care workers in Minnesota have seen all too well in the last few years what has happened when they have not had a united voice at the state capitol. They've seen cuts to their programs both across the board, as well as a 20% reimbursement rate cut made to PCAs who were related to the person that they cared for. And it took court action for that cut to eventually be ruled unconstitutional by the State Board of Court of Appeals in January. And that's why we see so many home care workers in favor of having the right to form a union.
Mr. Chairman.
President Benson.
To the author, But couldn't what you just told, what I was just told by your representative from the SEIU there, and what you said about the daycare providers, couldn't most, if not all, that be done by just coming to the legislature, as has been done in the past, and asking? I know many of the associations will come, and they'll lobby just like any other group does and make their voices known, and then we'll take a look at that. And in fact, with the majority of the House and Senate both being controlled by the majority party and the governor being the same, couldn't, in fact, if it's the issue of rates, say, hey, you know what, we want more money for that, he puts it in the bill, and we approve it.
Representative Benson?
Representative
Nelson? Sorry.
Too many Scandalubians. Representative Chair Johnson. Part of it, it's more than just the rates. It's having a voice, and yes, they could come down, but as some of the opponents to the bill in their testimony complained about, is us having hearings during the day because they're isolated in individual locations all around the state, and they aren't able to come down here during the day while we're doing our business because they're isolated and they're having to do their job, either take care of the daycare children or take care of the clients that they have as personal care attendants. And that is why they've expressed interest in forming a union, a collective bargaining unit, so that they can have a collective voice. That's been a long history in the formation of unions and collective bargaining units, that is to create that collective voice, because together they have more voice than individuals. And if we go back to our founding fathers, that was part of the thing of 13 states together were stronger than one state. Each individual state on their own, it's harder to break them apart when you got a collective voice.
One last question in this series. I know that you're wanting to get done in 45 minutes, but which, by the way, I'll just reiterate that, you know, they've had numerous years to add, you know, put people on the rolls as union, and we've had 57 people do that. But actually, his answer was a perfect segue for me to ask for Ms. Chase to come up and to explain what the role that her organization has in terms of helping people in the legislature understand the needs of the people that she represents.
Ms. Chase, again, if you'd identify yourself for the record and speak into the microphone here, please.
Katie Chase, Executive Director, Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care.
Go ahead. To Representative Benson's question.
Representative Benson, what would you like to know about us?
Okay. Well, we're here to discuss whether people should have the opportunity to organize, and I question the need when there is already a pretty good sized association that cares for the needs of people who want to belong, and there's an association fee from what I understand. Could you tell the committee again just exactly what you folks do and how you lobby the legislature on behalf of the individuals? And this is for clarification. I kind of already know you're up here helping to make sure that the regulations are fair and the children are safe and that you get enough training, but I'd like to hear it from you.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, committee members. We have had great success actually just during this session in working with the Inspector General and the Licensing Department at Department of Human Services in working towards licensing changes that are going to work, that are going to be best for children and still allow family child care providers to have a viable business. So we do have a concern, as I testified earlier, that they will have a hard time finding time to talk to us in the future if there's this exclusive representation, and I did discuss that with Jerry Kerber. Of course, we'd be able to still testify here and talk to all of you, but as you know, a lot of work happens before it comes to this point, so we are concerned about that. We do, however, we'll support whatever. I just have to state we will support a full majority vote of licensed family child care providers. That's our main issue for opposing this bill. It's not, our board of directors is just very concerned that so few licensed providers have a say in this far-reaching legislation.
Thank you. How about Representative Ugel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my questions are directed at Ms. Chase also. To the best of your ability, you guys put out a survey, and it seemed to me that the results were overwhelming. What were the figures that your membership support the formation of a union licensed family child care providers? What were those figures on page one?
Ms. Chase?
Mr. Chair, committee members, we had over 86% opposed. We had 5% yes.
Okay.
5% uncertain and 3% need more information.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
You go.
I would have to say that it's amazing, but that's about what my emails are running also.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I have one further question, Ms. Chase.
Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And what did your survey find about raising prices?
Mrs. Chase.
Mr. Chair, committee members, over 55%, I believe. Let me check that. I don't want to say the wrong thing. Yeah, it was over 55% would raise their rates.
Mm-hmm. One follow-up. Ms. Chase, do you have any idea how much money that would be in the state of Minnesota? Any rough idea?
Off the top of my head, no.
Ms. Chase.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, committee members. I would not want to say that off the top of my head, but there's 11,000 providers in the state of Minnesota, so it would be considerable, of course.
11,000 providers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good. Representative Nelson, comment?
And Chair Johnson and members, I'm not going to do battling numbers, and this is part of the reason why we want to get to a vote. I mean, we could get a survey, and I don't know the scientific value of the survey because I don't know how it was conducted other than done on SurveyMonkey, which I don't know how scientifically valued that is, but that's what that this is about, is getting to the people that have approached us about wanting to form a union, wanting to form a collective bargaining unit, to be able to get the list, get the names, send the ballot out, and have a vote. And if they have the vote and the vote gets turned down, that's what it's all about. It's not guaranteeing that there's going to be a union. It's not guaranteeing that any group is going to be the representative. It's guaranteeing that these people who have approached us about wanting to form a collective bargaining unit, that they are able to get to a vote and vote whether they want a union or not. And if they vote no, there won't be a union. This is what it's about. And if her survey is as accurate as she claims it is, she should have nothing to fear from this legislation, because there will be the results that she's claiming there will be. And that's where, you know, that's what this is about.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Metza has a question first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I was just wondering, so this bill only affects people who are receiving CCAP?
Mm-hmm. Representative Nelson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Metza, yes.
Okay, and so in kind of response to Representative Benson, I just wanted to point out, and I respect you being here to testify, I respect the work my mom did daycare for many years growing up, and it put food on our table all the way through when I was 16. But I wanted to point out that to me it sounds like they can keep doing their work. And bottom line, it sounds like we would like to have people who would, in Wisconsin, who might not like our governor, come over and vote in Minnesota in the election. And this is kind of what I'm getting at, is that some people in the organization aren't being affected by this because they aren't receiving the CCAP. And it's very specific to that group. And I just wanted to point that out for the committee.
Good. Representative O'Neill?
Yep.
Thank you, Chair. You had said that people had approached you. Can you just tell me who was it, daycare providers, or who had actually approached you and said, we want to do this?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
And Representative O'Neill, it's been both daycare providers, and it's been the union that the daycare providers have approached and said and expressed interest to them of helping them form a union. That's how unions are started. Unions are not created by the union coming out, some big entity out here. The union is the members that wish to join it, and it's those members that have come forward to the union and said that we would like to try and do this, and that's why we're carrying the legislation.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. And You had said that this only affects those that receive CCAP, and there's 11,000 providers. How many are currently receiving CCAP?
Representative Nelson?
I don't know the exact number.
I think that's an important thing.
Ms. Chase, apparently.
And maybe Ms. Chase has the number, or maybe.
We do. I also have that.
Ms. Munt, maybe we can have dueling numbers. Maybe they're the same. I don't.
Okay, we could do both, but bring the mic over to the young lady there, and if you identify yourself for the record and answer the question, please.
Chairman Johnson, I'm Jennifer Munt. I'm the Public Policy Director for AFSCME. The answer to your question, there are 11,000 child care providers in Minnesota who receive CCAP funding. About half of them are licensed, and about the other half are legally unlicensed.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill, further?
Thank you. And then how many total providers are in the state, not that receive CCAP, but then total providers?
And I'm sorry, I forgot your name again.
Mike. Chairman Johnson, the total number of child care providers in Minnesota is roughly 26,000. The numbers come to us from the Department of Human Services, and because the occupation is so fluid with people entering and leaving the profession, those are rough numbers. 26,000 total, 11,000 receiving CCAP.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill, further?
Yes, please. Thank you. And so the changes that would be advocated on behalf of these 11,000 child care providers, will that also affect the total 26,000?
And Representative O'Neill, who are you directing your question to?
Whoever has the answer, I guess. Sure, either the author, maybe. It seems like I ask a question, but I don't know. So.
Ms. Chase?
Chase,
respond?
Mr. Chair, it would affect the whole industry.
Okay, thank you, Representative Nelson. Further questions, Representative O'Neill?
The question was, of the author, since this is your bill, of the 26,000 total daycare providers in the state of Minnesota, if these 11,000 are making decisions on behalf of the 26,000, is that change going to affect the entire 26,000, all of the providers in the state of Minnesota, or only confined to those that are within the union?
Representative Nelson, or Lifeline to Ms. Munt.
I'll have the policy expert.
Ms. Munt, to the question, please.
Chairman Johnson, the primary reason for collective bargaining with the state is with respect to the reimbursement rates. Those rates only affect the people who are part of the CCAP program. So the 11,000 that would be negotiating reimbursement rates, that would not affect the rest of the industry. The rest of the industry would be free to continue lobbying the legislature as they do through associations and other vehicles.
Follow-up, please.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. What about, you had said about quality of care and safety, and the many things were said in this hearing that the unionization of these independent owner in-home daycare centers, not employees, but employers, which I don't understand why we would even want to unionize employers. But putting that aside for just a minute, what if there was other changes to their rules, their regulations, their whatever that have been negotiated, then would that affect the 26,000?
Ms. Munt.
Chairman Johnson, Representative O'Neill, the unions who have collective bargaining rights in other states have helped to improve training. They've helped to improve access and affordability for parents, and they have helped to ensure on-time reimbursements for the providers who are on a subsidy program. If we improve training, I believe that improves the whole industry. If we improve access and affordability for parents, I think that's good for the entire state. What we're looking to do is to improve the quality and the affordability of child care. That's good for every working family in Minnesota.
Chair, so then the answer is yes, that beyond the rates, it would also extend to rules and regulations and requirements, and I mean, it could go on and on and on. So these total of 26,000, only 11,000 would have a voice, so the rest of them would be dictated to without a voice. Is that what I'm hearing?
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, the issues that are concerning the people on CCAP would be what would be the bargaining of the exclusive bargaining unit. The other things that you talked about, quality of care, regulations with the state, that the people in the daycare union would have, if that is formed, would have a voice in that. But so would anybody else who's in the daycare industry would be able to raise their voice and speak with the Commissioner of Health and can speak with the Commissioner of with the state of Minnesota, the governor, any one of us, and raise their voice and also participate in that discussion. It wouldn't, that those parts of it would not be subject just to the exclusive bargaining agent of if there's a union is formed.
Representative O'Driscoll, I see you're on the list here.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, I've really been given this issue of some thought over the years because it's something that started out as part of the governor's executive order, which was ruled to be unlawful at that point. Many of the same principles are found in your bill here on this. And as I'm trying to think through this, and it's like, okay, it seems like this is more of an association than a union because folks can't strike. They'd be striking against family in many cases because 80% of the PCAs are family taking care of families. So I'm not 100% sure if it follows the format of a traditional union. And as I'm looking at Ms. Chase's organization, I'm sure that she's an advocacy for people, the legislature, and for the same kinds of things that you're looking at. So to my question, if parents aren't really happy with what's going on in their school district, they don't form a union to go out and negotiate with the school board for classroom sizes and different kinds of things. There's a parent-teacher organization, or the PTO, that they're members of, as a group, not unionized, common interests, going and advocating with the school district, building a better school system, and keeping things for kids. I guess I'm wondering, what is it that an association or non, if I could use the term union, because that's what we're using, is going to offer that's different than what the union's going to when we were talking about what's good for kids and those kinds of things. And I guess I'd ask you, and I'd also like to hear from perhaps the policy expert and from Ms. Chase, since they're both here this evening with us on that idea as well.
Representative Driscoll, maybe you want to pull your microphone around there too, because I think we're being taped here. Representative Nelson?
Chair Johnson and Representative O'Driscoll, just like confidential employees that we have at the state that aren't able to strike and aren't and can bargain and can have mediation and arbitration, this is the type of group that these people want to form. And this is what they've said they want to form. They purposely asked not to be, both groups have purposely asked not to be able to go on strike, so they want to be treated like confidential employees. And they want to be able to bargain for better reimbursement rates, which is not as different from quality education for schools. And they want to have a voice in the quality of daycare and the quality of and the training for PCAs. They want to have some voice in that, but that's not stuff they're going to be bargaining for. That's stuff that they want to have a voice in, and they feel that the union, the collective bargaining unit, will have the give them that ability to have a stronger voice here at the Capitol when they're home taking care of their clients as far as with the PCAs or the daycare people are taking care of the children that they're charged with.
Ms. Munt, did you want to respond?
Chair Johnson.
Pull the chair or the microphone a little bit closer to there.
Chair Johnson, committee members, child care providers don't fit the traditional union mold, but it makes sense for them to collectively bargain with the state because there's a direct financial relationship with the state setting the rates for their industry. Now, it may help you to understand why the child care providers approached us. Many of the child care providers that came to the union are already members of associations. In fact, DHS surveyed the industry and found that 45% of child care providers belong to one association or another. The difference between a union and an association is that 3/4 of the associations in Minnesota are comprised of 50 or fewer members. Only 6% have more than 100 members. Our union, without recognition, already has a larger membership, dues-paying membership, than 94% of all associations. The people who came to us said that the associations were unable to fend off the pay cuts, the training cuts, and the fact that the legislature ignored 7,000 families on the waiting list for child care assistance. They say we need a stronger voice. Rather than being a group of 50 or a group of 100, we would like to be a group of 11,000 people who advocate together for reimbursement rates that ensure that parents pay less and providers can earn a living so that they can support their own children.
Ms. Chase, did you want her?
But if I could, Mr. Chair, just have a little latitude because...
Representative O'Driscoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that you mentioned really intrigued me. I'd like to just go back where you said that your unrecognized group already has a larger dues-paying membership than others. Would that number happen to be exceeding or equal to or very close to the 10% necessary to certify a vote?
Our dues-paying... Chairman Johnson, our dues-paying members right now exceed 100. And we have not got recognition, and we do not have bargaining rights yet.
Thank you. If Ms. Chase could respond to the question.
Ms. Chase?
I don't want to get into a dueling match here. As AFSCME and SEIU know, we have worked together on a number of issues at times that we agree on. But we absolutely disagree on the fairness of the wording in this bill. Because, yes, this survey was made for only licensed family child care providers. This is what our expertise is in. We wouldn't speak to unlicensed. We wouldn't speak to PCAs. This is one reason we oppose this bill. The licensed family child care providers is the only group that is governed by licensing standards as far as Minnesota Statute Rule 9502 and many other statutes. So why would unlicensed providers who do not have to meet licensing standards have a right to decide the future of licensed family child care providers? And to address the idea that this was only our membership and not providers receiving CCAP, that's completely not true. Our providers receive CCAP. Some do, some don't. 90% of them have said they would, and many are even registered, but that program is so limited right now, the ability to even have, we testify alongside the union to raise those rates, but there's a lot of variables involved here. These people, the rights of a democracy and people in this country is they should be able to vote. And to limit this to only half of the licensed providers and allow other people to determine their rights without a fair vote seems unconscionable to our board of directors. So they have asked me to come here and implore you to allow this to be a fair vote. Also, you might remember in my testimony, I have piles of verified deceptive practice of organizing. So the whole system is, we're just very, very concerned about how this works. It's not a secret ballot. Give the people a chance to have a secret ballot vote, and we'll be done with all this. Save a lot of taxpayer money, and we can maybe raise rates then.
Representative Benson.
Thank you. To the author, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the bill, and in the last page, I'm looking at your severability clause, and so can you tell me why was the severability clause included in the bill?
Representative Nelson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, the severability clause in a lot of legislation that we pass, if you look at even our omnibus bills that we pass, there's normally a severability clause there. That's pretty standard as you go through on our bills, because sometimes we'll pass stuff and someone will protest about one piece of it, but then the rest of the bill stands. And somebody will take a piece to court and it may get thrown out. That's pretty standard. We put in legislation as we move forward through the process.
You've got a lot more. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You've got a lot more time than I do, but I certainly can't remember every one of our omnibus bills having severability. But I'll be looking for them. But what do you fear in terms of this bill, in terms of legal challenges? What are your fears? I can assure you that I've been told, at least, that there are many people waiting in line if it should pass to take you to court. But from your mind, what do you fear that might be an issue in the bill that would cause you to put it in?
Representative Nelson?
Like I said, that's pretty standard practice in a lot of legislation. And going back to the legal legislation, and I think Representative O'Driscoll raised it earlier, the lawsuit that threw out the governor's executive order. If you read the opinion of the lawsuit, it was thrown out basically on the path, the point that it was a crossing of powers between the governor and the legislature, and that the governor didn't have the power to do this unilaterally. That if they wanted this done, and that's part of why we're here, if we wanted this done and this to be created, it had to be done through legislation. And that's why the legislation is here.
Representative Simonson?
Mr. I have a follow-up, because I really didn't get an answer to my question, Mr. Chairman, in terms of...
Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What parts of this bill, however, are you worried about that might face a legal challenge and might have some difficulty?
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, I'm not afraid of any part of this. I feel that we've worked hard to craft this in a narrow enough way and limit to the ability to give these people a right to get to move together with a collective voice to work forward. I'm not afraid of it going to court and failing.
Representative Simonson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't actually have any questions, but I did want to make a few comments, but I'd be happy to wait till the end if you'd rather finish questions first.
Representative Uecker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My my question is directed to the union representative here. How many dues-paying members did you say you have in the state right now?
Ms. Mutt?
Chairman Johnson, committee members, AFSCME has over 100 voluntary dues-paying members right now.
Okay.
Tim Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how many daycare providers do we have in the state, did we say?
Ms. Mutt?
Chairman Johnson, roughly 11,000 who would be eligible to join the union if there is an election.
So, Tim Uglum. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm to understand that this entire thing, at least I feel that this entire thing is being driven by 100 or less people that want to organize here at this point in time, because you're always speaking about all the people that want to do this. So the real number is 100 or less.
Chairman Johnson, Representative Uglum, we have only begun to house call the child care providers in the state. If this bill should pass the legislature, we will make home visits to all of the folks who are on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, we're at that point where I think we can go into final comments. If people, rather than questions, want to make any final comments, then we're going to move to the vote.
I have questions.
Well, you have questions. I'm
sorry. Technicalities of the proposal.
Sure. Go ahead, Representative Pieper.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author, what would the dues be if they do unionize?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiefer, as has been stated, I don't know if we stated in this committee, I've testified in a number of committees, so I may not have said it in this one. The dues will be set by the members that join the union. And as in all unions, they're a democratic process, and they're the ones that choose and vote in a democratic fashion to set their dues. And that's we don't know what the dues will be.
Okay.
Kiefer?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's just assume it's $25 a month. And let's say that only the 11,000 are supposed to pay because the other ones maybe choose not to go into it because they're not getting CCAP money. And of those 11,000, even if they don't want to join the union, they still have to pay a fair share. Is that correct?
Representative Nelson?
Chair Johnson and Representative Kiefer, because this is being organized under a Public Employee Labor Relations Act in Minnesota, that would be the case. Yes, they'd be people that don't join the union that receive the benefits of the union, and then union negotiations would be required to pay a fair share dues. And the law states it cannot be higher than 85% of the dues. It could be lower than that. But it can't be higher than 85%.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I did a little math here, and boy, follow the money. We're talking 11,000 providers. Let's just assume they just pay $25 a month, and none of them join, so they're paying 85%. That comes to $2,805,000. This is a lot of money. Now, that's going to the union. I'm a little bit concerned about what Rep. Metz has said, that this is only affecting CCAP kids, because those are the very ones that we're talking about helping. And I'm afraid that there's going to be an unintended consequence that people are going to refuse to take CCAP kids because they don't want to join the union. And I'll tell you, on my emails, I haven't gotten one that said, oh, please support this bill. But I've got bukus of them saying, please fight this. So I want everyone to think about those numbers, follow the money. We've got someone here that doesn't even live in Minnesota testifying for this. I'm just amazed. Anyway, Michigan has this under law, and it's been under litigation ever since. So this is what we want to do. Put our child care providers in a position where now they have to worry about litigation and lawsuits and keeping up with this when all they wanted to do was care for the children in their neighborhoods and their communities. I guess I'll stop it at that, Mr. Chair. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak.
Thank you,
and I hope everybody thinks about that.
Representative Nelson.
Chair Johnson. And not to denigrate the person that came here from New York to testify, the reason she came here to testify was that in New York, they've had this for a number of years, and she was testifying of what has happened in New York, you know, to show people that this is what has happened there, and this is how it has helped and improved the daycare system in New York. And that's what that she was here for. And so I don't want to denigrate her because she took her time to come here and testify, and we shouldn't be driving her reputation down because she's from New York or from out of state.
Very good. Members, we're going to go for the last questions and comments as we go around now. And I see Representative Simonson, you're on the list, so go ahead. If you have a say, and we have a Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it's just maybe time to take a little different approach here. And before I start, I want to say thank you to Representative Nelson. And thank you to everybody that worked on bringing this forward and getting it to this point. I know it was a significant undertaking. And I really appreciate your efforts. But just to comment on a few of the things that have been said here today and tonight, and in full disclosure, I've been a member of a union just about all of my adult working life, so I really have a deep appreciation for what unions can do for working class people and quite frankly what they do to benefit those that don't belong to unions, which I think is often overlooked. But there's been a lot of talk about the concept of union dues, and first to the amount. I mean, we can't really debate what the amount will be here because the amount isn't set by the legislature. It's not known by anybody in this room. Union dues are set by union members and by voting union members, and it's their job to do that as part of their process within their own group. And when you belong to a union, you have to really understand that what you put in other words, the dues money that you pay, what all of the members pay, is truly about improving quality of life for everyone. You can't really take a fee that's paid by month and multiply it by the number of members and say, wow, that's a lot of money. You really have to break that down and look at what it's being invested in. Sorry, Mr. Chair, I missed that.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Rip. Just finish up your complete whatever you're saying.
So, to the survey has been talked about a few times, and quite frankly, when I first got this on the desk here earlier today, I was going to ask you, Mr. Chair, if it was even germane, because there's no question asked in this survey that's even relevant to the bill that we're discussing. Nowhere in this survey does it say, excuse me, what do you think about the legislature considering legislation that would give folks the opportunity to form a union should they want to? That question isn't asked in this survey. There's this concept still today in 2013 that the union is some sort of bad, evil thing and that it's some sort of dictatorship. And quite frankly, it's not the truth. The union functions as a democracy, and nobody in my entire adult life have I ever seen treat or have more respect for the essence of democracy than unions. And I can attest to that personally. I've gotten some of these emails too, you know, and the percentages are a little bit different that are coming into mind, but when I look at the emails, what I see is some miscommunication that's going out there, because most of the emails that I get that are opposed to this are saying, please don't organize this union, or please don't force me into this union. And I reply back and I say, that is not what we're doing. In fact, if you read this bill that I'm attaching to my response email, this is what we're doing. And quite frankly, I think there's some misinformation that's going out there. But to my final point, Mr. Chair, what is this bill really about? And that's the question here today. If we pass this tonight and this eventually makes its way into law, these workers are not automatically going to become union members. That's not what we're doing here tonight. We're giving them an opportunity to have a voice. And keep in mind that who will make that decision is the majority of those workers. Nothing less than the majority of those workers will make that choice. Don't try to twist that around in any other way, but the majority will choose as they always do in any sort of democracy. And finally, if the opponents that we've heard testify here today are correct and that truly the majority don't want to do this, then it won't happen. Then this will all go away and it will all be forgotten and it will not happen. And we can't stop that. We can't start that. So, again, thank you, Representative Nelson. I appreciate you bringing this forward and urge us to support this bill.
Just hold on. I just want to comment, to the membership here, obviously this is a very difficult issue where we have difference of opinions, and I think that's fine. That's why we're here in the legislature, because we feel strongly about certain issues, and this side of the table might feel one way, the other side feel the other way, and I think that's fine and good, and I think we've had a good discussion about some of these issues. So as members go around now and as we get close to that voting point, I'm hoping that you'll respectfully give your opinion, although not everyone's going to agree with it. That's fine. The vote's going to go the way the vote is. But let's just hear each other out in an honest and fair way and take it where it goes. With that, Representative Driscoll, if you want to share with your thoughts on this.
I guess I would like to be our last member, if that is the last person on the list.
That would be
have
fine.
A final word from our side, if I could.
And Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank the author as well. Both Mr. Nelson and Representative Nelson and I realize the value of union membership longer and probably more profoundly than anybody else in this room. It's not your grandpa's union anymore, but the cooperation between employers and union employees and their organizations is transformed into something of a miracle in the construction trades, at least as far as the training and safety aspects go. It's proof positive that positive things can come from cooperative ventures such as union employer relationships. But I was looking around the room and I realized that there's a handful of us in this room that are very, very fortunate to have known a man that served in World War II, and after the victory in Europe, he stayed in Europe and helped with the reconstruction of some of the countries there, and actually crafted some of the constitutions. I believe it was in Belgium, Austria, and those constitutions actually mandated union membership in some of the critical workplaces, the energy, transportation, communication, because there's a value in a well-trained, productive, reliable workforce. And if that's what is the end result of what we do here tonight, I think this is absolutely a terrific thing. So when Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Gerald Haney stuck his neck out in Europe and realized this is a good thing for all the critical trades or critical services that people need on a daily basis, I got to thinking, we've got some pretty critical services right here. And when it comes down to taking care of our elderly and those maybe least among us, that's very important work. And when it comes down to taking care of our children, there's no more important job. And if we can elevate the working conditions of people that take care of our children and come to realize that we can rely on them every day for the services that they provide and reward them appropriately, we've done good work here tonight.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Sundin. Representative Metza?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I always look forward to when Representative Simonson gathers his thoughts at the end of committee, and wanted to let you know he made a lot of the points that I was going to allude to, so I'd just like to move on to the next thing.
Representative Hoppe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't get close to the mic. First of all, Representative Simonson, sorry, we were kind of playing musical chairs while you were speaking. I apologize. We're just kind of trying to get everybody in. And, Mr. Chair, earlier today we were talking about my daughter who was babysitting, and afterwards I talked to and Representative Nelson and I were first elected together. I think we're friends. And I just want to, and I don't want to put Ms. Newman on the spot, but I think before this gets voted on, we need to make sure, I absolutely trust Representative Nelson. He's got tremendous integrity and character. Mr. Seid told me they're not looking to look at people that are doing babysitting, even if it's somebody that's doing this on a temporary fill-in basis. But I think that's what the language says. And I think we maybe want to make sure that gets corrected before we pass this. And maybe I'm wrong in my interpretation of it, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but if we could have Ms. Newman tell us that, if I'm looking at that correctly, I think Representative Nelson has time to get that fixed before we pass that.
Okay. Ms. Newman, did you want to take a crack at that at this time? Or?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this is a bit a field of what I know about, but it is my understanding that, and I think you're referring to the legal unlicensed child care provider reference that is made in the context of this bill. And it's my understanding that there is a definition of that. It's the care of children or people in just another single family, and that there is a registration process of some sort with the Department of Human Services. And if a person is one of those people and they're registered with the department but not licensed, and they care for a family or care for a child who is getting subsidized child care services, they fall under the purview of this bill. But if your daughter or my daughter goes and babysits down the block and it is not under a subsidy arrangement and they are not a legal, non-licensed provider, that there is a definition of that, as I understand it, in the child care law, they wouldn't be covered by this. But as again, Mr. Chair and members, that's beyond my expertise.
Mr. Chair,
so happy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Nelson, it might be something we just want to clarify, and I don't know if it's got another committee
stop
or not, but it might be something. I'm not an attorney. I've had a couple of people contact me today after the hearing saying that it's something that needs to be cleared up.
Okay.
I'll leave it at that.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Fisher?
Thank you.
Pull the microphone to you, too.
Oh, sorry. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. To me, this is a very classic case of people wanting to organize, and I'm a firm believer, and I've learned through where I've gone to church and everything else, that every person has a right to collective bargaining, and there are people here who've asked for that opportunity, and this doesn't guarantee them everything. I think Representative Simonson has made that pretty clear, that you know, if the surveys are right out there, this may fail, but we owe it to those people to at least have the opportunity. You know, if the surveys are right out there, this may fail, but we owe it to those people to at least have the opportunity to try and see if they can organize and come together. That's all it is. I think they're entitled to that right, and that's why I'm supporting this going forward.
Thank you. Representative Lane?
I was just thinking that Representative Hoppe's daughter babysitting, or any youngster babysitting, would not be paying taxes. It would not be in the same venue at all.
Thank you, Representative Lane. And Representative Driscoll, to you and then to the
Mr. Chair, do you want to go last?
Did you want to go, Representative Uglem?
Yeah, I had just one. I'll be brief. You know, sitting on this side of the room, I'd venture to bet that there's nobody on this side of the room except myself that was a union member. I worked as a Teamster for a number of years. That's the biggest, baddest union there is. And so I understand unions, I understand dues, I understand collective bargaining, and I understand the philosophy behind it. My problem is, I mean, it's just pretty simple. I just don't think that this is the businesses that we want to unionize. I understand the economics of it. I understand the politics of it. I won't be able to get around that. And I think we all know what the vote's going to be. But I I think unions have played a great, great role in this country for the middle class and everything else. But this is not the place for a union. And the other thing is, and it goes down to the politics and everything else, the way the election's going to be set up, the votes and things like that. I'd like to see it be much fairer. But that's my piece, and I think we all know what's going to happen. And, Chair, I certainly appreciate your comments about, you know, how we've conducted business in this committee, and you know, you let the chips fall where they may.
Thanks,
thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. So my sister-in-law is a child care provider, and 7 years ago when this push began, and I have, you know, this whole stack is just a partial list of other daycare providers that have contacted me and asked me to be their voice, one of them being my sister-in-law who lives just a few blocks from me. And she wanted me to make sure I told the committee emphatically that she is an owner, not an employee. She is already regulated by and licensed. She's received training, and DHS, you know, requires training. And if I understand correctly from the testimony, there already is a union, and then they can voluntarily join the union. So I'm having a hard time putting all these pieces together, but this makes sense in my world. My world out there in Buffalo, Monticello, Maple Lake, where I have, you know, 500 daycare providers in Wright County, it just doesn't make sense to me. But I don't understand why we are trying, why we're unionizing or offering this unionization to the employers, not the employees. The owners, not the employees. These are the owners of small little private businesses in their own home. They choose their own rates. They follow the rules and regulations already put out. They do the training already done, put before them by DHS. I don't understand why we're going after this group of people. The associations, in fact, someone had just said that associations are for employer groups. This is a group of employers, not employees. I don't understand why we're trying to unionize employers. This is just a huge disconnect for me. I have a tremendously difficult time wrapping my brain around why we want to do this. And the threshold is only at 10%, so I have a really strong concern with such a low threshold. I don't understand why we're not at the 30%, which seems to be a much more national standard. Those are some of my concerns, and the last thing I want to say, after reading dozens and dozens of testimonies from daycare providers all across the state of Minnesota, is that emphatically they are saying that if they are forced to be in a union, they will stop taking CCAP, and we will have less providers, not more. They are frustrated, and they emphatically said in exclamation points in every single one, "We don't want this." So that.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Representative Benson, you said something brief?
Thank you. Yes, I just a couple of comments. Some of it is just follow up to testimony, and even if you do the math and you bump that around that number up to 200, you know, that was said earlier, we have 100 or more. If you make that 200 or less, than we're talking less than, in terms of 11,000 people that take CCAP, less than 2% who have voluntarily joined the union. And I can tell you that on many occasions I've met with daycare providers with their concerns, not only about this but other things, that regulations in the state and so on. I rarely run into someone who says that they really want to join the union. I'm going to have to say that I still have some doubts in terms of, as we move forward, how everyone will conduct themselves in the solicitation for how this is done. My hope and my prayers are it's all done in a way that will make both the union proud and the people of Minnesota. I still have major concerns. I wish, as many have stated here, that we could have made this bill a little better. It can't be, and at least gotten that threshold to 30%.
Good.
And Representative O'Driscoll, and then to Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, you and I have been on a number of committees together and have seen an awful lot over the short time that I've been here. And one of the things I guess I would say is I think you've got probably the toughest two bills that got made into one bill today next to the health insurance exchange this session. And this committee probably hit critical mass with it today because it had been traveling independent in other committees, and members have had the chance to have their say, their thoughts, their questions, as has the public, and these two worlds collided today and became one. And so the committee, I know, had a lot of questions because this committee hasn't seen, as a standing committee, either one or both of these until today and where we're at. I still think that there's a number of unanswered questions, and I hope that they can be resolved as we move forward from this committee into other committees. We really haven't even had a chance to talk about who's going to pay for the election. There seems to be a disconnect on how we're going to make contact with the PCA group to do the elections versus the child care folks and the like. My real hope would have been we could have kept it at 30%. That was a very big thing for me because that's just consistent with PELRA, which has been suggested when we were in the majority that PELRA wasn't being followed, and it's been raised here. And I'll be first to admit by myself that PELRA hadn't been followed by changing that. And those laws were talked about, negotiated, and put into statute, not on a whim, but through both sides coming to the table. And for me, that's just a little bit disheartening. This is not about whether or not you like unions or don't like unions. Many of the people who are Democrats around this table and Republicans are supported by different unions. Some of them may be trades, some may be others. And so I don't think that this is at all an issue about we versus they. It's about having a good, open, honest discussion as Americans on the merits of the bills and on the merits of what's happening. I think to you, Representative and Chair Johnson, you helped us to facilitate that. And my hope is that we will continue to work through this and get to what's a equitable solution. I can tell you that there's lots of folks, because I've got over 200 daycare providers in my district alone, that when this whole thing came back up again, they were concerned about it from the executive order, and so I know that there's a lot of work that needs to be done in getting good, solid, accurate information out to people in order to be able to do this. And so my hope is that folks will remember the people that they're coming in contact with. It's not your normal employment group. These are small business owners, self-employed people who are trying to do some things. As Representative Mensa said, his mother had been involved in this as a small business owner, who are simply trying to put food on their table as well. And they also want to make sure that the people that they provide services for are able to have those services, and so that they can get out and take care of other parts and aspects of their lives. I don't think that's any different really from what you want to do and from what the other association wants to do. It's a difference of opinion. As long as we can keep it on the level of a difference of opinions and not make this a personal attack, unions against management, management against unions, I think we all do better on that. So with that, my final comment would be I would still like to have a roll call vote on the final vote.
Duly noted. And Representative Nelson, final comment.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee. And I want to thank the daycare providers, both the ones that are for it and against the bill, and the PCA providers and the clients that have come out and testified in committees. The jobs that you guys do are tough jobs. And the people that approached us and approached me and approached the union to want to try and form a collective bargaining unit, this is what this is for. We're trying to give them the opportunity to try and do that. And that's what this bill is about. But the bill does not do, again, what it does not do, it does not form a union. It does not guarantee that a union will be formed. But it allows the people who are interested in doing that the opportunity to be able to do that, to get to a vote and have a vote of the daycare providers across the state to be able to have that vote. And as I said earlier, if there aren't the people there to do it, the vote will go down. The people that are trying to form this union, they have a tough job in front of them. They're, you know, the cards that were already signed by people, those cards are invalid. Once this passes and once the drive starts, they're going to have to get that 10% starting from brand new fresh cards, and going forward from there, and they're going to have a limited time period to do it. Those are the current NELA rules about doing this, and so that's what's ahead of them. At no point are they guaranteed if it's success. All they are doing being guaranteed is the ability to try and do this, and the people that are interested in the ability to try and form this union so that they can better their lives. And that's what this is about.
Very good. Representative Nelson renews his motion that House File 950, as amended, recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. The clerk will take the roll.
Mr. Chair, just one other quick question. Since these bills have been combined into one, do we know any more information than we did earlier today on the track on this? Because I do believe that this is probably going to need to go to Health and Human Services Finance, because we put the PCA component in on that as well. So I'm just looking to make sure that we don't bypass the committee.
No, it's just at that point.
Well, we can check on that, but we're sending it to GovOps.
Mr. Chair, I was just whispered in my ear that that is correct. It will end up going to HHS Finance.
Very good.
Thank you.
And the clerk will take the roll.
Johnson.
Yes.
Benson.
No.
Fisher.
Yes.
Hoppe.
No.
Kiefer.
No.
Lane.
Yes.
Mason.
Yes.
Metza.
Yep.
Nelson.
Yes.
O'Driscoll.
No.
O'Neill.
No.
Savick.
Yes.
Simonson.
Yes.
Sundin.
Yes.
Uglem.
No.
The vote is 9-6. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Members, let me make a note before we break up here. We do have one bill we're going to see next Wednesday. So just for planning purposes, looks like Thursday's free, but we have a bill Wednesday. It's the Dolly agency bill. That's
Mr. Chair, can that just be our secret that we might not have committee on Wednesday after this deadline week?
Don't tell anyone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee.
We have no further business before us. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you.